Conference Committee will come to order. Welcome back, everyone. I know there's a couple members that are not back, but they will be shortly, we believe. And I know Senator Kubley has another conference committee, so he'll be back and forth. I think we should go to Commerce next. And then we want to hear from the Duluth folks because they're from out of town. So, is Commerce ready? Oh, I didn't understand. I thought you meant they had to make arrangements. I apologize. Sorry. There's somebody who has to be out of here soon. Sorry. All right. We'll take the search testimony. That won't take very long. Whatever. I think we'll give them a chance to testify next. Are they here? Please, come on up. Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't quite get the message that you guys have a conflict. Everyone's having a good time, so that's good. Nobody's too mad. All right. We, members, let's try to focus the testimony. The main thing that I want to hear from CERTS, well, the only thing I want to hear is what their proposal is that's in the Senate side that's not in the House side, and just explain briefly why you think this is a good idea and how it meets the requirements of the stimulus bill. Yeah. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon. Thanks for inviting us. For the record, my name is Lissa Polish. I work for the University of Minnesota's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, and I am one of the CERTS, or Clean Energy Resource Team's, coordinators.
Just let me interrupt for a second and tell members we're on page R14. Is that right?
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
When we initially had talked about this idea, one of the things that seemed absolutely critical to us in moving energy efficiency things forward was to reach out to people who weren't already thinking about energy efficiency. CERTS has been doing on-the-ground work in communities for the last 6 years, and one of the things that we find is that we're able to reach a certain segment of the population, but there's a much broader audience of folks that needs to be engaged in these issues. And this clean energy census, as we've called it, although census is, as I understand, not perhaps the best word, is to really reach out to 2% of Minnesotans through various outreach efforts, including a door-to-door effort, so that you would literally have people from a community going around to other folks in their community and knocking on doors and asking folks if they know about the opportunities that are available through Energy Star incentives and rebates, through new financing, through their local utility. And it would be very focused on a particular community, so that we wouldn't have people from Minneapolis going up to Polk County and knocking on doors. We wouldn't have people from Polk coming to knock on doors in Blue Earth. That it would be people from those local communities hired in those communities. We've talked about hiring just about 500 canvassers. It's about 473 canvassers per our estimate, and the bulk of the money would go toward paying those folks. In addition to the paid canvassers, we would also hope to recruit both students, folks from civic groups, retirees, other folks in the community to go door knocking. And we also feel that one of the benefits of this is that it's a way for people in a community to grab hold of doing something about energy issues. It also provides those folks an opportunity to say, this is something that I can do not only to change out my own light bulbs, my own appliances, but I can go out into my community. You can have that little green vest and have people know that you're not some random person trying to raise money, but that you're trying to talk to them about issues.
And for the record, Diana McEwen with Metro CERTS, the Metro region of CERTS, based at the Green Institute. We really have come forward as you know, Senator Anderson asked early in the session to come forward with ideas about the recovery and the stimulus money, and we threw this idea out there, and it kind of stuck in the Senate and kind of kept moving, and we're happy to be here to talk more about it. It was a really big idea that's pretty ambitious, and we, as we kind of move along this process, have been fleshing it out more and looking at kind of how this works, and kind of as we keep going along, going, oh, there's something else that we kind of didn't think about, et cetera. So I think that one of the important aspects is the amount of training that goes into kind of getting these people up to speed about how to talk to people, how to respond to people at the door, about questions. Because once you start at the door talking to somebody about energy, they think you're an expert. And we want to have these people really well trained. And it's really important to work with coalitions like HIRE. We're very excited about working with them and their ability to get into low-income and communities of color, which often campuses don't go to for a number of reasons. And so we're really excited about making sure people in all communities in Minnesota understand the great opportunities that are out there. And we do have some suggestions that we provided yesterday to tweak the language. We're concerned that the language as it is right now is pretty narrow, and the more prescriptive it gets, the more difficult it is for us to deliver, I think, a successful program.
So, thank you. Do you have specific suggestions on the language?
I do. On line 8.35, we would hope to broaden that so it doesn't just say door-to-door campaign, but that instead says, and conduct a statewide outreach campaign, including a door-to-door campaign, because we realize that it's very ambitious to talk to 2% of Minnesotans, and that one idea we have besides door-to-door, because not everybody opens a door, is going to events and things, county fairs, football games, places where we can get to people that might not open their door. But if they see some earned media of these green-vested people, they might approach them and get connected to some resources. And then on 9.11, 9.11, including women and persons of color with opportunities and resources to implement energy and efficiency and renewable energy projects. This language that was in there that was specifically about low-income having their homes audited for energy efficiency and weatherized was really narrow and was not the intent. This is not solely a program to identify low-income people for the weatherization program. I understand that the CAP agencies and others are you know, really set to go. You know, they have people. Obviously, if we turn up people through the door-to-door canvas that might be eligible, we would turn those, you know, encourage them to reach out to the agencies for low-income weatherization. But narrowing this project to just solely trying to seek out people for low-income weatherization is not what this was about. And then right below that, at 9.13, changing out the word must use to must include paid and volunteer youth and seniors. We are so excited to have youth and seniors, but that's not the only audience that we would like to recruit for this canvassing. We think there are people in between the ages of youth and seniors that might want jobs to get out there and do this work, and so we don't want to limit that. And then the third piece is under 9.16, conducting the outreach campaign, again, versus the door-to-door campaign, so it's clear that it's broader than that. And I think, you know, as my colleague said, it's really critical for us, in order for this to be successful, we need to be able to work with the local utilities to make sure that people are connecting to them with their rebate programs so we can count those savings, those SIP savings, towards the goals that the state has. And that is our goal. We are committed to that goal. Part of the CERT's, you know, mission is to make sure that we're helping meet those goals. And so that takes some pretty significant, very localized training. That can't be statewide training where everybody comes and learns about the utility programs, because each one is different. And we're really committed to making sure that there's a partnership there, that we turn those, you know, that we work with those folks at the local level so that people know the specific rebates, incentives, et cetera, that the local utility offers.
Thank you. Senator Dale had a question.
Sure.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I've been hearing the word CERTS all session, but I don't remember what it stands for.
Clean, Senator Anderson.
Ms.
Senator Anderson. Clean Energy Resource Teams.
And Senator Dill, we've funded these over for how many years? Through
Chair Anderson.
Go ahead.
Ms. Polish.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, CERTS has been funded over the last 6 years. For our first 4 years, we were funded by the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources. During the previous funding round, we were funded as part of the Renewable Development Fund, and we hope to be funded again through the Renewable Development Fund for the upcoming 2 years.
And they are
budget. Madam Chair, it's Clean Energy Resource Teams. Is that right? So the last, the TS is
Teams.
Yeah, okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, so it's five different regions around the state, and seven. Sorry, it's seven different regions around the state, and they each have their own team, and that's why it's a plural because it reflects all of the regions around the state.
Do you, Ms. Pollitt, just for example, do you have anything that is in Senator Dill's area that they're working on that might refresh his memory? Just, I hope.
Please, God.
Pardon me, Madam Chair. Senator Dill, can you tell me again where you're from? I apologize.
Meeker, McLeod, Wright County.
McLeod County? Yeah, so Meeker, Wright, and McLeod County.
Right.
Okay. Well, actually, Madam Chair, Senator Dill, we actually spawned a local group called Preact McLeod. We had, for a while, we were creating mini certs or baby certs, as we called them, that were a way for local folks. Part of what we do is we work on this regional level. So we have regional educational forums, and people can then take those ideas back to organize in their local communities. And CERTS has provided them with an opportunity to say, look, I'm part of a bigger group. And so there are a number of folks in McLeod who've been doing some organizing around energy issues, energy efficiency. Some of them are now in retirement homes, and they've been looking at energy efficiency projects in those retirement homes and facilities. They've been looking at how do we do outreach around solar thermal, even at some of those facilities. I mean, it's a very local, it's a local organic thing, but there is actually a good bit of activity.
Okay,
in
thank
area.
You.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kalin.
I just wonder if, so CERTS is the overarching umbrella. I believe the effort in Senator Dill's area is an Altoids team, correct? And then you have Tic Tacs all over the state. Is that how things are working? So that's,
okay,
for those of you playing bingo, that's the bottom left.
They all do have fresh breath, sir.
green vests and fresh breath.
And Madam Chair, I think the other question, and then I'll actually move on to substance stuff, is whether, in addition to the vests, we'll be providing eye shades of the same color. I wonder, you know, Section 1606 of the stimulus bill requires the prevailing wage, and I wonder if we have any answer on what the federal prevailing wage is for canvassers. And I said only semi-tongue-in-cheek because I think there is a real question here about the entire nets of the federal rules and this effort, and also just will raise the question about volunteers, whether those are eligible, and I think it's probably more in Mr. DeFebre's ballpark to give us a definitive answer, but if you guys have, I hear that it seems like you've considered this, so where are we at?
Yes, sir. Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, when we were actually going through and doing our initial budget estimate, we had talked about hiring 473 canvassers to work roughly 25,520 hours, all at $12 an hour, to actually do the canvas itself. So we had included that $12 an hour wage. We would also need to be paying them for the training period up front, so there would obviously be additional hours that they would need to get paid. But absolutely, sir, we are talking about using that federal number.
And Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, as a former canvasser, I don't think it's enough money.
Well, there is the prevailing wage requirement, I guess.
Absolutely.
Will this meet that requirement?
It was my understanding that $12 an hour did meet the federal wage prevailing, the prevailing federal wage requirement.
For canvassers. There actually is a prevailing wage standard for canvassers. Apparently. We can ask Commerce to check on that as well. All right. So you are aware of that?
Yes.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Kalin.
I have some concerns, and I've heard them from others as well, about kind of the effectiveness. Somebody shows up at my door and says, I'm here from the government and I want to help you. Now, tell me how old your windows are. What's the, you know, there's a lot of reticence to providing that kind of information. I wonder whether the utility engagement may be a key here, that I like the idea a lot, and I think I've communicated this to you guys personally as well, that the outreach, especially in the residential area, in traditional efficiency has been really lacking, partly because you have to go, as Senator Anderson said, door by door, block by block, and, you know, having worn through multiple pairs of shoes during campaigns, it's a lot of work, but it's really, really effective. Whether we're going to get an actual census out of it and whether we're going to get the information, I'm very skeptical on that piece. I wonder if we couldn't find a way to work with our utilities to the sort of model where, you know, you can indicate interest and on your bill and or through community grassroots engagement in our co-op territories and others where they're not meeting the goals yet that we need them to meet on energy savings or doing some good work there, but they need some help. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if flipping the model to a structural model within SIP might be effective. Can you speak maybe to those conversations that you've had there? And
mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative
Ms. Polish.
Kaelin. Absolutely, it's critical that the utilities be involved. I guess I wouldn't want to be the one to say you must participate with us, but obviously we want them to, and though the offerings that they have are public and it's absolutely critical that they get connected to folks, I think that I understand the concern about a census and going in and saying, so how old is your fridge? And that people say, why are you asking me that? And slam the door in your face. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's more effective to say, are you aware that there are incentives to change out your fridge? And there's also an appliance harvest program that would provide you an additional incentive to get rid of your old fridge. And that's a more proactive approach. It connects them with that without giving that knee-jerk, why are you asking me about my business kind of thing. So I think that that's sound advice, and I think that that's something that we definitely will need to do to make sure that we get people to take as much action as possible and link them with the resources. To your earlier comment about that reaction to you're someone from the government coming to my home and telling me to do something, that's part of why we've talked about recruiting folks from those communities and from those areas to come door to door so that it's not somebody from the government, but through the coalitions of folks that we're going to work with, it's people that you know, people that are from your community that you might see at the grocery store or mm-hmm. wherever, so that it isn't that take. But absolutely, we need to be working with the utilities. We also need to make sure that people are aware of the federal incentives and how those are coming to their, you know, coming through their utilities. But that's critical to making it happen, and that's critical to changing the game on the ground.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was it Ms. Polish?
Polish, like shoe polish.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am. I'm having a hard time following the value, actually, of us spending the time and effort going door to door on what I would call cold calls. I was wondering, have you thought about the idea of utilizing this kind of an effort as a follow-up to an original contact, maybe from the utility companies? And I'm wondering if the utility companies wouldn't be better suited to be, if it was residents, if we're talking about, and I'm kind of envisioning this, would be trying to reach out to the residential side, why we wouldn't have folks have gotten something from their utility company to talk about all these different opportunities, and they get it in the mail. I got to be honest. I'm assuming you're alluding to a safety vest that your folks are going to be wearing. I'm sorry, but you can go to every big box store now and buy those. If that's the way we're going to identify people, or I just don't think people are going to, they're not even going to believe you when you come to the door and say, I want to tell you. I would think we'd be better to have the utility company let folks know we've got, you know, the McNamara household on 6 and Pine Street, and they've got old appliances and bad windows. They've identified this, and we've offered a service to come out and visit with them, and then you come out and visit. I think your time would be much better spent, and I don't know if this model would work, Madam Chair, something like that. I just really think, I don't even know if people are going to believe you.
Ms. McHugh.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I think first on the vest, I think the actual original idea came from Senator Anderson, green vest, not a safety vest that anybody would wear. You know, you'd see somebody working on the street wearing, but a green vest that was identified. And a big part of what we're going to try to do is a large earned media campaign that people become really aware. So in local newspapers, thinking about a press release to the local newspaper before we go into that community, maybe with some pictures so people are aware when these people come to your door, it's those green census, whatever we're going to call this. I don't know that we've decided on a good name yet. And people are aware of those people coming to the door, which I think is a really important aspect of getting them to do that. I think, honestly, that if bill inserts from utility bills worked, we wouldn't be in this situation. I think a lot of people take those, they take their bill out, they pay it, and the rest that's in the envelope goes in the, hopefully, recycling. But that, I think it's really about getting out and talking to people face-to-face, and it's about building community and having them, and again, like my colleague said, somebody from their community coming to talk to them about opportunities that are coming down the pike that I think most people won't really understand or know about, and that we're trying to get beyond. I mean, again, if those utility stuffers, they send out, Xcel Energy sends out the Saver Switch, notice, and I think there's still a lot of people that don't know about it, that they get a discount if they sign up for the Saver Switch for their air conditioning, to cycle that off. And it's a great benefit. So, it's about really educating folks that wouldn't normally pay attention to those utility bills, and really trying to use local community organizations to, kind of alert people and let people know that, they're coming, we're coming, to that neighborhood.
That said, let me just also add, if a utility wanted to put an insert, a bill insert in, absolutely. Right. That would be great. And maybe that would be a great way for them to announce, we're collaborating with this group to do it. But I do think it takes more than that. I mean, I've worked with utilities up in the northern part of the state where we've said it'd be great if we could advertise to folks that there are these incentives so that if they went to remodel their home that they were aware of it. And I've had some of the utilities tell me, you know what? Nobody reads those. And I know that that's different utility by utility. If they wanted to do that, that would be fabulous. And I think that working in a coalition and bringing new partners to the table, all sorts of people are going to have new ideas about what to do. We sent this idea out to some friends who said, wouldn't it be great if you changed out the porch lights at each home that you visited with a compact fluorescent right then and there? Have the utility sponsor those compact fluorescents so that you get them to take an action right away. I mean, I think that there are all sorts of great ideas. And yours is maybe one of the ideas that we should start to integrate along with all these others.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. But I can't believe that. I mean, I realize that if you're talking about a utility stuffer, but now all of a sudden you're saying, hey, we've got this 25% upfront credit or a 25% rebate, there's this much available. I mean, really, the $1,500 stimulus for air conditioner furnace replacement has been significant. But I got to be honest, I think seeing that in the mail or in a local newspaper or something is probably better money spent than someone going cold door to door. Believe you me, for those of us that spend a lot of time walking door to door, there is a very little value in every door you go to a lot of times. And so especially, I just hope you're looking at all the options, because it seems like, especially when we're under the time constraint, and a lot of the information the utility companies, I would just think, have a lot of good information. And I agree with you. If it's a stuffer in a utility bill that they just put in there because they're under the 1 ounce and they could stick it in there, I would think it would have to be something pretty targeted, pretty good, that would work with a follow-up from you folks.
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Polish.
Representative McNamara. I think that's also part of why we've really wanted to make sure that the language says outreach, including door-to-door, because I think that we do hear what you're saying. I mean, to reach that many people on just the door-to-door, I think overestimates the capacity. But if you can also go to the Vikings football game on a Sunday and have people out, giving out the magnets and talking to people about energy issues, people start to see that these folks are out and about talking about it. I think it does make you more receptive at the door. You can leave a little door hanger when you leave. And I think looking at community events like county fairs, like National Night Out, like those sorts of things, again, start to add to the recognition that this is a movement and a big push happening in those communities, and adds value and adds understanding of who those folks are that are knocking, so that you might actually think, hey, I read about that in the newspaper, and now somebody's knocking on my door. I want to open the door and hear about this. This is my firsthand interaction with this group.
Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Polish. I'm just curious. I'm looking at the handout, and you suggested 2%. How did you arrive at that number? And then have you thought about, because 2% obviously isn't the whole community, or the whole state, have you thought about which communities you might target? Or
Senator Anderson, Senator Rummer, we're both looking at our papers. Which papers did you get? We have talked about which communities. We've talked about in greater Minnesota that we would go to the 4 or 5 densest population centers in each county as a starting point. We did 2% of people thinking that that's about 40,000 folks. And as we were talking about the canvas itself, we were estimating that in a 5-hour evening, you could stop at roughly 125 homes, get about 25 to 33% of folks to answer their doors from this group, 10% of them to take some sort of action, which would mean that about 21,000 people would take action and that you had knocked on 640,000 doors.
Thank you.
Well, and I think if you just, I'd ask if you could just focus for a moment on your chart on the back here about the savings, the energy savings. I know it's sort of like, you know, it's a projection, but I think it's a pretty conservative projection. It's your handout.
You have this? It's the handout from yesterday?
Yes.
Okay.
And it says an estimated energy.
Right.
Savings.
And this is part of actually, Senator Anderson, yes, this was some estimates that our then colleague Carl Nelson, who is now working at Center for Energy and the Environment, was looking at when we were putting together a proposal to the Bush Foundation and thinking about how could we actually achieve on-the-ground energy savings and looking at average household electric usage and some common conservation measures that people could take and what a realistic sense of savings would be. So if you could get 10% savings at these homes, you know, where that would pencil out. And you can see the assumptions in the data. I don't have the whole. Okay, there we go.
This is the chart.
So this was giving folks a sense for if we reached out to this many people, and so you can see that at the top, number of households participating. So the top is, you know, if we assumed 10,000 households participating, the total potential savings at $19 million per year, and if they did, you know, did half of that at $9 million. Not doing the very best job explaining the table, but I think we could go into more detail about this. But these are just sort of to back up the kind of savings that you could achieve with this. This isn't how we came up with the number of households that we would reach. That was more based on the number of hours per canvasser and the people that you could get to at an event.
Other questions? Senator Rummel.
But you did, when you calculated, you went through the how many houses you would hit. What was the total number you thought you would finish and get to buy into the campaign after
21,000.
21,000
from the door knocking itself.
So if we look
at 40,000 overall. Yep.
Yeah, we look at the chart here. It would be saving $1.6 million, which more than covers the cost of what we're suggesting for the allocation.
I can't see it.
And I think I do think your estimates are important. That you're I think you're being reasonable. As Representative McNamara said, you know, people do get burned out from folks knocking on doors. And I know if someone comes to my house who doesn't have, you know, there's been some people recently who come by who sort of say, I need you to vote for me for this leadership thing. And they don't have a uniform, they don't have a clipboard, they don't have a name of who they're with. And I'm like, sorry, I'm busy, you know? And I know they're going to end up asking me for money by the end of the pitch, and I don't have time to waste. And I'm not going to give money to some stranger unless it's some organization I'm familiar with, okay? So you have to get beyond those barriers. And obviously the rest of us at the table know what it's like to get people to open the doors and talk to us. And it's got its challenges. So I think, I don't think this is pie in the sky, though, because your estimates are, like I said, I think they're pretty conservative. If you get a quarter to a third of the people to even open the door and 10% of the people to do anything, to take any action. I think that's, that's optimistic, but that's not unrealistic. And it's not assuming everybody's going to want to talk to you. It's assuming most people won't want to talk to you, realistically. I mean, Representative McNamara, you have to agree with me when I say that, and you door knock probably more than I do as a House member even, but that I have many, many constituents that remember conversations I had with them 15 years ago at their front door. And I honestly remember some of those, because some of those are the most significant contacts you've ever had with that constituent. People don't forget. If you can get in the door and get someone to listen, you can actually make a huge impact. So I think there's some power of doing this, but it would only work if there is broader visibility for the effort. I mean, if it's just a bunch of random folks with clipboards, that's one thing. So I think the reason that what would make this successful is if it's something that we can get media coverage of, if people can really get the idea, this is kind of a green energy year for Minnesota, you know, and everybody's going to have a chance to participate across the state, and this team is going to be delivering that message all across the state, then I think we have a chance to make an impact. That's why I think, you know, a real outreach plan is an important part of maximizing the effectiveness of these dollars. Because I just, you know, the utilities have had SIP requirements for years and years and years, and I think they do a pretty darn good job at energy at meeting those energy savings requirements. But they don't get that many new people to participate every year in the opportunities that are available to them in their homes. And that's sort of the big untapped potential that we got to figure out how to get to when we have this money out there to make it happen. So, Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, I think you just made the comment this morning, didn't we, hear that, you know, the utilities, they do a great job, especially at getting the commercial folks to do the energy savings, but it is very, and I don't know even if it's a good fit for the large utilities with the burdens that they have to try to get to this house-to-house individuals that never get reached. So it seems to me this is a tool to fill a niche that isn't a good fit for large organizations.
And they certainly need to partner with the utility programs.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I think everyone would agree. Representative Kalin.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, I find myself wondering what problem we're trying to solve with this piece in the stimulus bill. Obviously, outreach and advertising is a critical component to make sure that, especially on the residential individual piece. The question is this the right tool for this job? I'm quite interested in the tool. I think that the job, the reality is that the reforms that Senator Dibble and I carried in 2007 to SIP to move from spending to savings are to requiring energy savings are only now becoming fully mature, and this is the first year, I believe, of any utility having to be part of that ramp up to full savings and KWH and BTUs saved. And so we've only started to scratch the surface. There are some IOUs and some co-ops that have never lived really in a deep SIP world where they have really gone after those savings. And I would say that the most successful and a nation leader, Xcel Energy, has done a lot of the work in the, and thank God Chair Hilty's not in the room, in the low-hanging fruit.
Is that a bingo square?
Yeah, that's center square in the House on conservation. I think that there's a real need for this integrated outreach grassroots component in the utility world. I think that the question on the outreach comes to is this the most cost-effective way? Do we have hurdles in the way of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act rules and the prevailing wage and other pieces that I think we'll have to hear from OES? And I just doing the numbers, because I am a House member and been through three campaigns and over 30,000 doors personally, I end up about a fifth as many jobs in sort of walking through how you get from, you know, the 640,000 potential doors, which actually I think is about a third of the state, and sort of, you know, there's 2 million households walking through that stuff, but that doing the math, I'd like to do this offline and actually have a chance to walk through this, but the math doesn't add up.
Okay.
From here. So I like the idea. I think there's a great utility in the utility world and in the SIP world, but I'm just struggling with, does this serve the need for outreach is public service announcements? I mean, the huge bang for the buck in your area, Senator Dill, I would imagine, you know, Senator Kubley, where you have small markets, you can get great penetration in those areas that, Xcel Energy and others, GRE, of CenterPoint, Conexus. I love I think it's Conexus, or the ping pong balls in the gymnasium advertisement on conservation. That was a phenomenal, powerful ad that was on last year. Those, I think, may be a much more useful means of reaching this audience for the stimulus. So I guess I've spoken a lot, but I'm struggling with this because I love the concept. I just don't know that it fits stimulus.
Well, Representative Kaelin, I guess what I would say is everything you've mentioned is really an important strategy, and I think we need kind of all hands on deck. We need all kinds of strategies, and we need more than we've done in the past, more than we're already doing. And I think I'm open to ideas if you have a better idea about how to really expand what we're already doing and multiply it by 10 or more times. That's what this is about. We're trying to think of a quick way to get to more people in the short time period that we have. And I'm not sure that just doing what we're already doing is going to get us there. So that's my concern. If you have a better idea, I'm all ears.
Well, if I could just ask a clarifying question. Which piece of either your bill or mine, and we'll come to Kumbaya here in the next few days, and hopefully by tomorrow night we'll have a bill and the governor will sign it. Which piece of that are you thinking that we're going to need to increase demand out in the public in order to take full advantage of those resources?
Well, the fact that we have, we've got $130 million for weatherization, and we've proposed, each of us, somewhere in the vicinity of $10 to $15 million beyond that for residential homes, which is $150 million roughly compared to what we normally spend in a year from the public sector for these for residential energy efficiency work. It's at 10 to 15 times what's normally spent. And so that's – the money's there, the programs are there, but how do we get the people beyond who we already have on our lists? How do we get more people to participate?
Well,
to meet that, to really make use of that, you know, that's the purpose of the stimulus funds, as far as I know. And they're looking to Minnesota to figure out the best ways to do it. So we're trying to look at some creative approaches. Representative Kaelin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that we're clear on what the need is, because my understanding, and I hope we get to hear from OES and the community action agencies, is that there's a long wait list currently, that there's not going to be a shortage of demand for the LIHEAP weatherization homes. I might be wrong about that, but my understanding is that we have those loaded. I'd be interested if Ms. Blankenship is in the room and we can hear from her later again, or someone else might be able to speak to the 15 million or 12 million, whatever the number is, for residential that's not the low income. Whether there's concern about needing being able to fill those. But I know that, you know, Representative McNamara and I got to speak with Jim Humphrey, the CEO of Anderson Windows, where they've hired back folks already just because of the tax credit. And hardly any outreach at all other than some ads in the local papers. So, like I said, I think this can be a tool to do exactly what you're talking about on the utility SIP side as a long, ongoing structural component rather than a single-time outreach. I don't know that the need is there.
Right, so you're suggesting the utilities should be going door-to-door?
I'm suggesting a partnership, Madam Chair, between CERTS and the utilities.
Yeah,
because
and I agree.
Okay.
I just wasn't sure if you were talking about that the utilities should be doing this instead of what CERTS is proposing.
Oh, well, Madam Chair, if Dan Pfeiffer or Joe Sullivan or others knock on my door, I'm going to slam it as soon as I can, you know, if Ms. Polish or Ms. McEwen knock on my door, I'm more likely to. No, I'm just kidding. But no, I think there is a real need. We've heard this over and over and over in this SIP conversation about a need to get deeper penetration and deeper participation in the residential market. And I think that's where I think there's a real strong opportunity to leverage.
Absolutely. And so that's what this would do.
Well, Madam Chair, what I'm suggesting is that $1 million of stimulus funding or half a million or any stimulus funding may be more problematic than actually requiring utilities to develop this and strengthen this partnership and to use CERTS as the outreach arm for residential efficiency so that we can test, develop, hone this outreach strategy in residential efficiency. For instance, I know CenterPoint has come to us and asked for relief from their 1% spending or savings goal for natural gas to ask us to drop it down to 0.75%, a move that I have opposed because they have not fully developed their residential insulation program. Knocking on a door and finding some partnership where, as Representative McNamara said, where there's willing participation or at least some first pass, so it's not a true cold call, can actually get the folks on the hook and then set the hook by saying, here's your opportunity, here's your cost share, here's the finance mechanism. And maybe the Duluth Project and other innovative projects can show us ways that maybe we'll have some data there where they, in the long run, we can say, here's the one-stop shop, here's the package together, done.
Well, Representative Kalin, I feel like we're talking about the same thing here, and so I'm having trouble understanding why you're saying this isn't the way to go, because you're saying we should do something like this, but the utilities should do it as part of SIP, not now and not with this money. And so I'm trying to hone in on what the difference is, because it seems to me we have an opportunity to demonstrate some models. I've gotten the sense from the utilities they want us to give them ideas and opportunities to improve their residential SIP outreach. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly why I think this is the right time to try to put some funding in place that we might not ordinarily have to get some. And the Duluth Project and this are two ways to sort of demonstrate what may be a better way to do some outreach, and then the utilities can try to replicate or build upon that. That's exactly what this is intended to do. All right, I'll call on Ms. Polish, then Senator Kubley, then Senator Dillon.
Madam Chair, sorry to interrupt, Senators and Representatives. I just want to quickly say that I do think that jump-starting it at this point could be a really great opportunity. There's a lot of focus on the ARRA. People want to see how that money is being used, and I think that this would be a great on-the-ground representation of, here's the opportunity that we're connecting you with to get those actual savings. There are also, I think, tremendous job opportunities to get folks trained that are parts of communities today and get them trained with that energy expertise and knowledge so they are go-to people in their communities for years to come to help the utilities move this kind of stuff forward. And there are now trained people on the ground that have done some energy work, are moving forward in that. I mean, we've talked about a number of different career paths for green jobs, and I think that this could be one of those starting points for people to get on the ground in their community experience. And I think that, Representative Kalin, early on you mentioned, what problem are we trying to solve? And absolutely it has to be to get energy efficiency things done now and to save money, but I also think that we're trying to figure out how you provide lasting on-the-ground change. And part of that happens through changing folks' mindsets. And I think that the idea of partnering with utilities is a fantastic one. Maybe this is a great way to kickstart that. But we can use these dollars to invest in creating that change in mindset, a change in understanding of what the opportunities are, what savings means for homeowners, renters, whomever, to actually get that done in their homes and residences.
Senator Kubley. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Representative Kalin, I guess I'd just like to offer a few thoughts for your consideration. I think public service announcements are probably a good one, and I would have to say that initially I didn't think going door-to-door was a very good idea. But the more I thought about it, I mean, I don't have any communities where the population is concentrated. My largest town is 5,200. My second largest town is 3,200, and it goes down pretty fast from there. You know, I have 54 incorporated towns and 7 or 8 more that are not incorporated. Some of those smaller communities, I'm sure every house in town would qualify, and yet public service announcements, be they via print media or broadcast media, I think are going to miss the people who need it the most. I don't know how to say that. I mean, who would be the most eligible by anybody's way? I thought, well, the window people are going to market this because they want to sell more of their product. I mean, you know, I think there are going to be a number of people marketing it. But I still think that going door-to-door, at least in targeted areas of the state, is really the best way to make sure that we get to the people that would like to be in the 2%. I mean, I've been in some of those houses in those dinky little towns where they may only have 20 homes that are occupied that have sheets hanging over their doors in the wintertime because they can feel the cold air coming in. You know, they need something other than what they've got, and, you know, they're, well, some of them are elderly people who don't drive. You know, it's kind of like I tell people when you're out in a heavily rural district like mine, you run into a lot of people. They won't write to you. They won't call you up. But if you show up where they are, they'll talk to you. So I don't know. I guess I think that that this plan is a good one. You know, it may not be needed in every area of town. In fact, I don't even know if we ought to go to some areas of the city that obviously have, you know, high-end homes, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know if they would need this kind of coverage or not. But, you know, in a rural area where the distance between towns is going to consume more of your time than knocking on all the doors in town, I think it might be the only way to go there. So I don't know. I'm just offering those thoughts for your consideration.
Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I have an idea that I think is illegal.
This sounds interesting.
Well, as long as you're not asking for a vote, Senator.
Well, if we're going to pay these canvassers $12 an hour, why don't we hire somebody that can get the door open? And I know that if a woman comes to the door, it's much more likely to get opened. If you hire a man. And now my son was in college, went to Kansas to sell books door to door, and he was teamed up with another girl from Litchfield, and the girl did so much better than my son did because the people would open the door when a woman was knocking on the door. So I suppose it would be illegal to say we're going to hire 473 women to canvass.
I think probably you're right, Senator Dillon.
Okay.
But thank you for the thought. Yeah. Representative Champion. Oh, and by, yeah, go ahead, please.
No, if you want to.
No,
say
please. Go right ahead.
When we think in terms of, or just another thought, you know, in the event that the committee goes down that track, I'm not saying you're going down that track, but I see in the Senate language that it talks about these canvassers would be youth or seniors, if I'm reading the provision that is appropriate. I tend to think that if you're going to go that way, a word of caution or something I would hope that you would consider is making a provision also for low income, because low income is something that's not there at all because it has youth and seniors. Now, arguably, they're both low income. I mean, when you think in terms of youth don't have any money and our seniors are probably on a fixed income to some degree, but I would hope if the spirit of what I heard the testifier talking about around being the gateway or the threshold to people becoming a little more involved, I think that you would provide an opportunity for some of the low-income folks to really have a real opportunity. And if we can think in terms of how do we do that in real time to really make sure there's some intentionality, if that's the direction that you choose to go, and I'm not advocating one way or the other at this point, but just wanted to make sure that low-income is not being lost in this terrain.
And Representative Champion, just to clarify that the language does require outreach to low-income persons to have their homes weatherized and audited, but not necessarily, it doesn't specify to hire them to do the canvassing. So I think that's the point that you're making, to try to create opportunity, job opportunities for people who really need them.
Absolutely. We don't want them just to be the objects of commerce, but we want them to enjoy the revenue stream as well.
Exactly.
Madam Chair, can I respond to that quickly?
Yes, Ms. McKeown.
You weren't probably in the room when we mentioned several times that we are currently working with the Hire Coalition and hoping that they will refer a number of folks to us And two, whoever does the actual hiring of the canvassers, because we do very much commit to hiring people from North Minneapolis that work in North Minneapolis, from Willmar that work in Willmar, from Duluth that work in Duluth. And so we're very committed to that. We're working with the Hire Coalition and are really excited about the opportunities to work with them to find people that want to do this work and that are excited about it. And I just want to go back a tiny bit to Representative McNamara's comments, and we really appreciate your comments about door knocking. It's not easy, and it's challenging. And to help raise the profile of this, we welcome any legislator that would like to go out in their district and door knock with these folks to help raise them earned media opportunities. We think that would be really, really great to go out with us. We plan on doing it ourselves in our own communities. If you want to join us in your community, we welcome that opportunity.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll hear from OES, I hope, on the prevailing wage question and a couple of other things that go to the challenge of using stimulus funds as opposed to another structure. But I think to Senator Kubley's concern, I think in terms of what problem we're solving, if there are sufficient numbers in terms of the projection of 25,000 LIHEAP-eligible homes to weatherize that are in the wait list or in the queue, that number is sufficient, but we don't have geographic balance, I think there's an important problem to solve there. So I'd like to hear from the community action agencies and from OES about, do we have that balance? My understanding is that we may have that, but if we don't, I think your point is very well taken. My concern, and I think from about late January, I've taken a very deliberate effort to downplay the expectations from this bill specifically. Because I think there's a danger of creating, using the president's term, false hope, of saying there's money out here to weatherize your home, but $132 million is going to be exhausted faster than we can say $132 million, unfortunately. And knowing that there are 400,000 income-eligible households in the state for LIHEAP, and that we're going to be helping 25,000 of those 400,000. It's a really sobering math when you think that 375,000 homes and households in the state are not going to get help, are not going to see weatherization because of this bill. And I just want to be very careful in that in this balance that we create. I think there's an opportunity here to do that long-term transformation through a structural partnership with the utilities, perhaps, rather than with the stimulus funds that get us there. But it's something that's been eating at me for quite a while in terms of wanting to make sure that we can deliver on the promises we make, both from the bully pulpit, but also at people's door and at the grocery store and at the Vikings game.
Ms. McEwen.
I just want to be really, really, really clear about the low-income weatherization. It was our intent for this to be a broad-based opportunity to go to let Minnesotans know about the opportunities that are down the pike. Again, if we find people that we believe that are eligible for low-income weatherization, we will refer them to contact the CAP agencies. But the intent of this, once again, really clearly, is not solely to look for folks to connect with low-income weatherization. We understand that they have plenty of people on the list that they can work with and that they're not looking for a bunch of us to reach out and find more people that and give them false hope that they might have an opportunity that isn't there for them. So I just want to make that very clear because this language, as it is, prior to our suggested recommendations for changing it, makes it look like that's the sole reason that we're doing this. I just want to make sure that it's clear that that's not what we're trying to do, is really focus on low-income weatherization and finding people for that program.
Ms. McKeonan, I don't think it was our intention to focus it primarily or only on weatherization. It's always been a community strategy or a neighborhood strategy. So in my mind, and so if the language doesn't make that clear, we do need to fix it. So, I mean, it's about going, if you go door to door, you get who you get.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, wherever, whatever situation they're in, you offer what's available. And I think Senator Kubley's point is that there's people who might be eligible for weatherization who might not be on a list for various reasons, who have never connected themselves or availed themselves of the opportunities. That's one universe you may be able to tap into.
Yes.
But beyond that, this would be, you know, random income levels in, you know, maybe a low to moderate income neighborhood, you'd get all kinds of people. And so I think that was what I understood it to be focused on. So I think, and again, I think you're right, there's no false hope here, Representative Kalin, but I think I would measure the success of what we're doing in this bill is if it creates something that can last, mm-hmm. as well as have a big impact. It's if it builds capacity that can really carry into the future, I think we'll be really successful. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I understand it, what CERTS would do is actually identify people who may be eligible for other things that they don't know about.
Yes.
So it would actually take this allocation and magnify the other opportunity. So it's not all the expectation out of just the stimulus money. Is that right?
Well, they would be able to tap into utility SIP programs, low-interest loans at the state and federal level, rebates, whatever is out there they would connect people with. It's, you know, and so, yeah, it's beyond stimulus for sure. And I do think, I mean, Representative Kalin, I really agree with you that I think we're in agreement that we need to help the utilities get out to more residential homes and do more work in those areas. And we have to find ways to help them figure out how to do that more cost-effectively. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really interested in demonstrating tools that can get there. And whether this is a tool that would work, that's what I'm hedging my bets on, as well as Duluth, but we'll have to convince you of that. Any other questions for CERTS? All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Now,
you
probably missed your child care deadline anyway, but we tried. And I know Commerce is – you guys are just going to be here, right? So I apologize for moving things around. But
I asked them to bring a sleeping bag and tent, and I think they're
there. Well, members, in fact, in terms of scheduling, I should just tell you the Senate has a caucus scheduled for 8 o'clock tonight. So that's kind of my – yeah, a follow-up caucus. So I figure – we can at least work till 8 tonight, so, I mean, perhaps with a dinner break. But anyway, that's kind of the rough ballpark that I'm thinking about.
Have dinner for the I-90 party.
Well, that's tonight, isn't it?
Well, I haven't made it to any of the parties yet. I've been working too much, but that would be fun. I think we'll bring up the folks from Duluth next because I know they need to get home.
And they've probably been
Representative Hayden, did you want to join us at the table and sit in?
Oh, no, thank you.
You're very welcome to.
Wanted to come and say hi and give my support to whatever you guys decide.
Hi, thank you. Join us anytime.
Oh, he's off to hell and human sacrifice.
Welcome to the conference committee.
Thank you.
And members, let's find the pages that this is on as well. R7.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and senators and representatives. My name is Tony Cuneo. I sit on the Duluth City Council and am the Director of Policy and Planning at the AgeZEPA Family Foundation. Yeah. With me is Jody Slick, Executive Director of Common Ground Construction. And I thought I would just do a quick introduction of the program, kind of list some of the partners we have, walk through what this program would feel like to a household, to a customer of this program, maybe mention a couple of the strengths, and then I'll hand it over to Jody, who is more of our technical expert and will probably be able to answer more of the questions than me, at least in a more detailed way. So, you know, I think the partners that we have that have helped put this program together is really one of our strengths. We have both of our utilities, Comfort Systems, our gas and water utility, and Minnesota Power, our electric utility, have been a part of putting this program together and have been at the table all along. And so we think that's a great partnership to start with. Beyond that, the City of Duluth, Community Development Office, and the Mayor have been involved in this planning process. Duluth LISC, of course, the ZEPA Foundation, and Common Ground Construction Company have all been kind of the team putting this plan together. Now, in terms of what it would feel like to a household or to a customer, the idea is really, and I'm sure this is one of the spots in the bingo card, to create this one-stop shop, to make it as accessible as possible to homeowners and to citizens in our community to get home residential work done. So if I were a household, I would be able to visit this organization, this one-stop shop, and with them help schedule an advanced energy audit. That advanced energy auditor would come to my home, and when I say advanced energy audit, I mean, you know, blower door tests, thermal imaging, and an audit detailed enough to develop a scope of work that would prioritize projects, weatherization, efficiency projects, that would give me the best bang for my buck or return on my investment. From that, I would work with this one-stop shop to get a list of contractors in my area that have been trained in the latest techniques, building science training, on how to do whatever efficiency work the audit said would be the most useful or highest priority. I would pick from that list of contractors, schedule the work. Now, if I were unable to finance that work up front or afford the upfront costs, what we've built or what we're building here is a loan product. So I could pay back this work. I could pay the contractor. Actually, what would happen is I would probably pay back the one-stop shop who would pay the contractor. And the idea here is to pay back the money out of the energy savings each month. And so, you know, my personal cash flow, my household's cash flow, would, if anything, hopefully go up. So whatever that, say, if my bill were $300 and now after this work it's $200, I'd be using $85 a month to pay back this loan and maybe keep 10 or 15% in my pocket until the loan is paid back. I think the other thing that we want to build into this program then is a quality control, and so the energy auditor would come back to the home after the contractor did the efficiency work and just ensure that we are going to get the energy savings promised. And, you know, that's kind of the bulk of the program. We certainly are thinking very broadly how we make this program accessible and you know, are working in partnership, whether it's a door-to-door canvas, whether it's a partnership with utilities. We think there are a lot of creative ways we can reach out to the community to let them know of this opportunity. I think some of the strengths of this program are key, or one of the key partners that we have that have helped put this together. Certainly, the buy-in from both Comfort Systems and Minnesota Power is extremely important in terms of working with our energy utilities to make this happen. I think it's key that it's based on in building science, that nothing happens without an advanced energy audit that really prioritizes the best return on investment kind of work that can get done in each home. This is a program that helps fill an affordability gap. You know, there are lots of resources put into low-income weatherization, but if you are just above that low-income line, you may not be able to afford the $2,000, $3,000 that some of this air sealing and insulation and weatherization work. So we try and overcome that barrier by creating a successful loan product. We know that we need more contractors trained in this work, and we need more high-level energy auditors. And so we know that this is a job creation program, and we know that that's a key part of the reason behind the Recovery Act. And, you know, lastly, I'll just mention that it saves a significant amount of both energy and money for our community. You know, in the kind of the case studies that Minnesota Power has experimented with doing some of these advanced energies, they believe that we'll be able to find consistent savings of between 20 and 30% per household. Now, we know that we spend hundreds of millions of dollars in our community on energy. Even a 20% saving, the lower end of that, leads to tens of millions of dollars staying within our community. And so, you know, we believe that that's higher level economic development as well, and another, you know, main key or main point of this Recovery Act. So I'll leave it at that and let Jody mention any other details and go a little more in depth at the program.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess as we have looked at this program, the conversation started in our community last fall when we were facing the situation, knowing that a number of households in our community may be at a heat or eat situation. As you recall, what gas prices and utility prices were last fall, long before kind of the full stimulus conversation was being held. And at that time, again, a broad range of community partners got together to define what those steps are that we should be looking at. If we could do one thing in our community to make that situation better, from this point moving forward, what are the things, what are the steps we should be taking? And so as Representative Kalin asks, you know, what is the problem we're trying to solve, we identified in our community that we don't have one problem, but we do have one solution that helps to solve a number of problems. And as Tony mentioned, you know, the energy affordability gap. If you've read the On the Brink study, it's not just our low-income people that spend a considerable amount more for energy than would be considered affordable. Those that are at the median income and above are not finding energy affordable. The economic development, the fact that we're exporting all of this money out of town that we could, if we put these conservation measures in, we could be saving. And so as a community, we went through the process of saying, if we want to be conserving energy, where should the priority be? Minnesota Power, one of those, again, that have been involved in this, had worked previously to do a study that gave us some good science-based information, financial-based information as to what we could do with houses. And they had also been working on developing an energy conservation pyramid. And this program is designed about doing those natural first steps, which involve the low-cost, no-cost solutions that you've heard from the CERTS group that CEE has been involved in with some of their neighborhood energy projects, et cetera, and then moves into the air sealing and weatherization. And if we want to be successful to reduce that energy, overcoming the barriers that the family sees. So we, as part of this program, do have a community campaign. Community Action Duluth is putting together as part of workforce development a youth summer jobs program that specifically targets employment opportunities to low-income youth. They're doing a canvas this summer and are proposing one also then for next summer that would take care and do some of that community education. And through that, help funnel into this next component, which is really getting the auditors into these homes and making sure that there's follow-up work. Because we did find from the pilot project that had been done is just because people got the energy audit and could see that there were things that they could do that would financially pay for themselves in 2 years or 3 years or 5 years, where it's a really good financial equation, they weren't necessarily taking that next step. And so this program is designed to make that next step seamless, easy, and payback that family and the community long-term. Create jobs that are sustainable and energy savings that are sustainable.
Great, thank you. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you're aware of programs, similar programs in other cities in the state. Are there any other efforts similar to what you're doing in Duluth in other regional centers or other outstate areas? Or?
Ms. Slick.
Sure. I know that CEE in the cities has a variety of programs that they have put together. They have worked on the low-cost, no-cost energy and are looking at working with six communities kind of in the southern area and then two northern communities, one of which will be Duluth, to put together, again, more of the community organizing education portion of that. There are some programs that have been created throughout the United States or in development throughout the United States, and we've tried to design our program to kind of overcome some of the difficulties that those programs have run into. And for example, we think a tool like the Minnesota Housing Money is a very good tool to have out there, but we do know that some programs are put together in which an energy audit isn't done. So what you do is you go in and you replace a furnace. But if you had done the air sealing and weatherization instead of just replacing that furnace when it expires, you could have actually put in a smaller unit. And, in fact, that air sealing and weatherization would pay itself, you know, off much faster than the furnace. Same thing with programs that the intent was to save as much energy as possible, but it may become just a window replacement program. So we've tried to design our program very specifically to say partnering And leveraging all of these other things is absolutely great, but the first step we need to do is what has the best return on investment.
Representative Brainerd, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Lay, thank you for that. My question may actually be for the Senate, since you put this bill in your, this program in your bill, and that's, I understand the value of this program, and it seems to me modeling really strongly best practice, but my question is, how do we extend that to the rest of the state? We're offering an opportunity to one area of the state without understanding how we might make that available to other regions.
Senator Prentner-Soland, do you want to address that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Brainerd. And maybe Ms. Schlick could speak to this, but the people in Duluth haven't actually been working in isolation either. They've been networking with people around the state who are looking at similar types of models. And actually, when we wrote the bill, I hadn't put Duluth in here. I never said Duluth. It was for a program that had, you know, particular features, and perhaps Duluth was the most ready to be able to implement that. But it was meant as a demonstration model that could be replicated around the state.
And Representative Brainerd, you know, I agree. We tried to do as much of this bill for statewide use as possible, because everybody deserves to have part of this, and everybody should. We should support these kinds of efforts wherever they are. But I was really, the reason I really focused on this Duluth program is we were looking for models that had all the different pieces in place. They had the community organizations. I mean, not just nonprofit organizations, they had the utilities, they had local government, they had all the different pieces intact, local, everybody at the table. They had utilities that were willing to be partners. They have sort of the outreach plan and the actual energy savings plan, but the piece that we're not seeing in most places yet is this kind of innovative financing. And that's something I've really been looking for, a demonstration, or, you know, I'd love to see it across the state, of where you can pay for your energy improvements with the energy savings. You know, we've talked about on-bill payment as a possibility, or putting on your property tax assessment, but it's hard for a lot of utilities to figure out how to do that. And I've had a lot of conversations with Xcel about that, and they're, you know, they're struggling with the concept as whether they can do it or not. I would love to see us, you know, demonstrate that that can be done, and that it would actually have the result of getting more people to do the energy efficiency improvements in their homes, because I think, you know, my gut tells me it will, because people don't want to go take out a loan, even if they know it'll pay for itself in a few years. But if it's that simple mechanism of saying when you pay your bill, you can, you know, you just have to keep paying your bill, your energy bill, and it's going to get less eventually. It's just so much easier and more transparent, and I just think it opens a door to people to do something, take a step they wouldn't have taken. So I'm really excited to see how that works. Senator Prentner-Soland.
Madam Chair, just one other piece, too. The other thing that makes this very suitable for the Duluth area is that it is one of the oldest communities in the state, and it has very old housing stock, and so it has some very inefficient homes and a great opportunity for doing a concentrated type of weatherization in neighborhoods.
And it's cold and windy up there.
Yeah.
Representative Galen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Senator Solon, you sort of stole my thunder a little bit there, but, you know, to Representative Brainerd's question, Ms. Slick and I met for the first time in Washington, D.C. at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference, where I was fortunate enough to be on actually the most fun panel I've ever been on.
It was great.
It was actually hilarious, believe it or not. I know my House colleagues can't imagine me being funny, but everyone else was funny. I think the most remarkable presentation was not our leadership here in Minnesota in terms of our efficiency and turning into jobs in the Green Jobs Task Force, but it was actually the Long Island Green Homes model, where they have really perfected a financing tool. I think that we may see a different financing tool ultimately emerge out of the Duluth project that I think will add to not only the state conversation. I think, you know, this discussion we had about the CERTS proposal is really about getting them over the hump on the, you know, what problem are we solving? How do you pay for it? How do you show those results? I'm pretty convinced that we're just about over that hump with this tool. I want to hear confirmation later from Office of Energy Security that we can do the revolving loan fund that I think will make this a lot easier. But I'm really interested in it, and I know that the nation is actually looking to Minnesota on energy efficiency and built-in and buildings because of our cold climate and because of the 20-year, 30-year track record that we have. I don't think we've ever put together something like this proposal that could do the one-stop shop piece. So I'm really interested. I hope that not just one finance mechanism is chosen, actually, that we can see how one works better than the other. But I think it's a very interesting proposal, and I appreciate the time that you guys have given me and Chair Hilty in walking through the opportunity. I will point out that the willing utilities in this case, you know, I think Minnesota Power and Comfort Systems, which is the yes. municipal utility, right, that they've been key in saying we can do this, we can do the on-bill payment. And like you said, I don't see Excel in the room, but solve that problem. Solve that problem for Excel because that's been the hurdle for us is doing the on-bill payment at Excel. So I hope that we can prove that we can do it, and we can say, give them a little kick in the fanny and say, let's do it.
Ms. Slick?
Well, I want to make sure that we're very clear. One reason why Duluth is a nice place, besides the fact that 50% of our homes are older than 80 years, you know, and a number of other components that always make Duluth special, colder by the lake, not accepted. But Duluth does own the gas and water utility. And so here is a place in which there is an opportunity because Tony Cuneo is a city councilor, is boss. there are some opportunities to look at and explore models that would be much, much more difficult. And so Minnesota Power is a regional organization, and plugging in with their SIP and their technical assistance has been wonderful. But our intent here would be to be working with and through the city of Duluth to start out with. But I do understand the question as to how do you take something where there is this one-time opportunity of stimulus, work out the kinks, that's what we're talking about here, and then make sure that this is something that can move beyond the community of Duluth. And one question would be is where do those funds to kind of do that improvement come from in the future? And I think there are a number of opportunities. The one that Representative Kalin speaks of on Long Island, they classified carbon as a solid waste, and then took some of their solid waste reserve funds to come up with the initial dollars in their community to do the improvements. There are other places that are looking at private investment, because one thing we do know about energy is you can model out the savings. And so the state of New York is looking at putting together a fund in which what it is private investors basically getting a guarantee because the energy savings are there. And it's an opportunity we have in this particular field that we wouldn't normally have to put together funding for the future.
Yeah, I think there's a real opportunity for private investment in this area in the future, but it has to prove itself first,
right.
And that's why we need some real on-the-ground opportunities. Representative Reiner.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have no question about the potential value of the project. It's very exciting and promising. I would just encourage us to look at the language so that it's clear that this is a model project with the goal of producing something that's replicable throughout the state and that other people can take advantage of instead of just happening to fund an innovative program in Duluth. And I would say the language could be improved to show the place of the project if the project is indeed going to be a part of the final bill.
Thank you very much. That's a really great suggestion. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since Ms. Slick brought it up, I wanted to take this opportunity to ask Councilor Cuneo about the prospects for Duluth to continue to own its gas utility.
Council member.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hilty. It's my understanding that it's not going to be an issue. I get the sense that the idea that had been floated by the administration in Duluth is kind of not taking that stance anymore. And I don't know if you're asking my personal thoughts on it or my opinion on the likelihood of it happening in Duluth. One or the other, I'm happy to answer either. But
you don't have to choose.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to. I think that Comfort Systems is in safe hands in being owned by the city, and I think it's going to stay that way.
Madam Chair, Senator Brenner-Solan.
I would concur as a former council member. This comes up about every 20 years and came up during my term in office also. But there is a strong support from the community of Duluth for wanting to own their utility, and it beats it down every single time.
3 years longer than the locust, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Okay. Representative, who's next?
Well, I'll just make a quick comment about the Long Island Homes model. They had to sort of go through some really clever mechanisms to be able to access the tool that made everything work, a sort of linchpin or keystone, as it were. But when I asked, I think a few weeks before, I was on a webinar with the staff member who put Long Island Green Homes together, and I said, you know, it's really, if you can work with your legislator, you can change state law. It's a lot easier. And he wrote me offline saying, well, in New York State, we don't work with our legislators. We don't have a very friendly relationship with our legislators. It's Albany is its own little fiefdom. And I would just point out that we have an opportunity to show a much more straightforward, easily managed way of doing this rather than having to go through convoluted means. I congratulate them for being very, very innovative and clever, but we don't need to be too clever by half here.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if it's for Councilman Cugno or Ms. Slick, but of the grant, of the $1.5 million, would any of it be used for administration, or is it all grant money?
Well, it actually is meant to set up a revolving loan, and so in the end, those funds will continue to revolve in the community. We understand that the first set or the first utilization of those funds would need to happen according to the ARRA time frame, and then they would continue as those funds are paid back from the energy savings go to complete more weatherization and air sealing activity for additional households, which is one component that we liked as a community because we want to be able to train and maintain jobs as opposed to seeing kind of a spike of activity for 18 months to train people to do work that then has the market pulled out from underneath it.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So all the money would be used for loans, or would be no administration out of the city, or whoever administered it wouldn't get any of this money?
The final budget is being worked out. It is going to revolve. I can't say that 100% wouldn't go to administration, but they are looking at, in the financial model for the payback, doing an origination fee to the owner to help cover some of the administration cost.
Certainly.
Councilmember Cuneo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative McNamara. Certainly the intention is that the vast majority of the $1.5 million would be used to kickstart the loan, the revolving loan fund.
Well, and Representative McNamara, just want to point out, maybe you've seen this already, but we did require a local match, and we put in $1 for every $4. That was kind of an arbitrary number that we threw out there. We think there should be local participation if we are going to, you know, designate a particular community. We need to have local partners and contribution, and that would be a possible way for the local match to work, is to cover administrative costs. That's one possibility. Ms. Slick, on that point?
I was just going to say that those that have been involved in designing this program, it's not just about the loan, but it's really looking at a comprehensive program. And so there are other funds that are being leveraged into that from workforce development. We have a number of foundations that are involved on the Green Jobs Initiative, which is where this is coming from, including the Zeppa Foundation, Northland Foundation, others. And so there's a number of components above and beyond just the loan fund that are being covered by other local sources.
All right. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much for coming down, and we appreciate hearing all about it.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right. Let me ask if I saw Greg Gray. Is he in the vicinity? Right. Oh, good. Greg, do you want to come and talk on behalf of the CAPS briefly?
And Arnie said he's willing.
And Mr. Anderson, come on up.
You're more important. You get the center chair. No.
Welcome to the conference committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. Our members are the primary delivery vehicle for the weatherization program.
And I'm Gregory Gray. I'm the director of external and governmental affairs for Minneapolis Community Action Agency.
All right, who wants to go first? Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. In conversation, my understanding was that one of the points that you were hoping that we would speak to was the question of administrative funds and training and technical assistance funds. And on that point, as with many of your previous witnesses, we would encourage as much flexibility as possible. We feel that we have an exceptional partnership with the department and are comfortable working with the department as this program unfolds to deliver the high-quality services that we all expect in Minnesota, and that hopefully will position us a little further down the line for some additional bonus federal funds, and that will demonstrate to Congress that this should not be just a one-time-only program, but this should be the start of a tremendous conservation effort. To put this conversation just into a little bit longer context, if we just look back over the past year, we've seen oil go from $140 a barrel back below 50. We've gone from having a shortage of construction materials to now having a shortage of jobs. So if we fast forward and try to imagine what will be required to successfully deliver this program, who can imagine exactly what we will be facing? And for those reasons, we encourage the concept of up to whatever number it is that you all feel is an appropriate number. If I could just be glib for a moment, thinking back to the old days, if Governor Perpich were governor and we provided up to 20% of training and technical assistance to the department, there might be some concern that it would end up at the Hibbing Community College. We feel that we have a very strong partnership with the department, and that if there was anything unusual happening, that particularly with the consultative process that's being proposed in this bill, with quarterly reports to the legislature, as well as just our ongoing relationship with the legislature, that collectively we would be able to address those in a constructive fashion. And if I may, I would add one further point. One of the complexities with this program, of course, is the potential for the Davis-Bacon prevailing wage requirements. And even as we sit here today, we still don't have a decision from Washington, so we still don't know exactly what it is that we're going to have to deliver.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, you just indicated your testimony was that you were unsure if the David Bacon requirement would be necessary. Here's my question: when we think in terms of the funds coming through the federal stimulus in order to be provided to OES to you all and allocated to you all for weatherization, What's your understanding as it pertains to other federal law or other federal requirements being being necessary for you to follow?
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair and members, in a general way, when and community action agencies work with a large number of state agencies, not just the Department of Commerce, any federal legal requirements, regulatory requirements are passed through to community action agencies as the delivery entity, and generally also include the requirement that they be passed along to any subcontractors or subgrantees with whom we may operate.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Champion.
So just to make it clear, it is your understanding that if there's language that's provided, because I'm looking at both the Senate and the House file, and the House, you know, talks about, you know, that all the federal requirements with every allocation must be consistent with federal law. But then I'm looking at the Senate side where it says a past providers of weatherization services must be fully used based on their capacity as determined, blah, blah, blah. So is it safe to say that if the Senate language is accepted or the House language is accepted, that those past providers, let's say if they were all majority firms, that they would have to adhere to the federal rules and regulations as pertains to inclusion when we think in terms of the vendors that you all select to continue working in this area of weatherization?
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair and members, it might be best for us to defer to the department for that, you know, kind of a technical specific answer. What I could offer in general is that to the extent there were any existing federal requirements, they already have been transferred through the contracting process, and to the extent that ADRA contains any new or additional requirements, then those would be carried through as well.
Madam Chair, are we going to have someone from OES testify?
So I want to just make sure. I decided to let them bet clean up here today, so we'll take other testifiers, and then they can respond to all the testimony.
Thank you.
So thank you. I'm just looking at the language on R4, and I think the House and Senate have similar language saying existing providers of weatherization service must be used. The Senate says past providers, but I thought I remembered that saying existing, and I don't know if that got changed at some point. Anyway. That's the language you're referring to, Representative Champion?
Yes, Madam Chair. On R4, mm-hmm. when I look at the side-by-side, starting at line 2.15, mm-hmm. it says past providers of weatherization services must be fully used based on their capacity as determined by the Commissioner of Commerce mm-hmm. for stimulus-funded activity before additional providers of weatherization services are added. And there was no reference to any federal requirements once the dollars were allocated to your local, let's say, community-based agencies. And I just wanted to be clear that the federal requirements survives even once it gets all the way down to the federal action agency.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kaling.
To this point, Madam Chair, Representative Champion and I spoke about this over lunch, and I think we're working on getting the exact federal language so we know exactly what those requirements are, not only in the existing code, as well as in the stimulus bill. So we hope to have some greater basis. I think obviously we want to follow federal law and ensure that we're doing it to the T and the spirit as well.
That's what I used to say. I'm sure it's not existing. All right, I had Representative Saylor, I think Representative McNamara, and Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just would like to have you expand a little bit on the plans and scope for some of the rental units. I'm noticing over on the Hall side on Subdivision 2, 3.33 through 3.6. I'm just wondering, you know, I would like to hear a little bit more about exactly how you would plan to do work with some of the rental units. I'm thinking specifically of big old buildings that the landowner currently does not do anything to in the way of doing weatherization, and meanwhile the tenants are just left, you know, unable to recoup any of the, any help at all. I'm wondering what kind of plans you might have for that.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, a more detailed answer probably can be provided both by the Office of Energy Security and Housing Finance. The short answer I would offer right now is that as soon as we receive the news of the stimulus bill, collectively we started meeting to figure out what are the barriers and what can we do to do a better job with the rental units. While I was sitting in the audience, I don't know if I'm stealing anybody's thunder, but we just received notice that HUD has, or I think DOE has accepted HUD's eligibility requirements as eligibility for weatherizing rental units. So that will, that's an example of the kind of barrier that we could remove. My understanding is that in the past, one of the barriers has been a requirement that if a rental property is weatherized, that one of the terms of the contract is that the landlord is unable then to, or needs to agree to not raise the rent for a specified period of time. I know there have been conversations about whether this is the time to invent a better way to deal with that issue of profiteering. I don't know that we have a specific answer as we sit here today. I might defer to Mr. Gray. Perhaps Minneapolis has had more or different conversations.
Madam Chair, committee members, Arnie's absolutely right. I mean, one of the stumbling blocks has always been the fact that we do have to get buy-in from the landlords, the owners of the property, and that often slows the process down. In particular now, when we have this fixed limit of time in which to spend this money, it becomes even more imperative that we have some buy-in, that we can move quickly. Although in Minneapolis, we have already started the process with a variety of organizations to make sure that there's a substantial portion of rental properties that are weatherized, as well as single-family home owner properties. So we're certainly aware of that. We realize that low-income families often are renters and not owners, and can benefit dramatically from this weatherization program. So we're focusing on that. I know in Minneapolis, I also know in terms of Ramsey and Washington County, the metro area in general is focusing on that rental issue. Madam Chair, if I might, too, since give Mr. Anderson a break for a second to relax his vocal cords. One of the areas where Minneapolis has kind of been more vocal than the partnership overall has been the issue of eligibility for weatherization services. And as it stands now, Minnesota, the eligibility is somewhere around 180%. I think they use a percentage of median income as opposed to federal poverty guideline numbers, but it's around 180%. Whereas the federal legislation now allows us to move to 200% of poverty. Having worked not only at Minneapolis Community Action, but having served as the executive director of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty, I think we all are aware of the fact that folks below 200% of poverty are in desperate need. And for us to cut off services at 180% when we can move up to 200%, we feel is a difficult pill to swallow. In addition, as Mr. Anderson has talked about, one of the words that we're going to focus on in all our testimony is the word flexibility. We need to be able to move quickly. We need to be able to give people one set of answers to questions and not multiple sets. And to the extent that people know that the federal legislation says 200%, but yet we come in and tell them it's 180% in Minnesota, or to the extent that we have 180%, but later on the department decides to move it up to 200%, and there's certainly conversation about that. We feel that we send mixed messages and confuse people, and it would certainly be more efficient, it would be more effective, and I think it would be more fair to elevate our limit, our lower or our maximum up to the federal guidelines. And I've provided both the Senate author and the House author with some specific language that we at Minneapolis Community Action would like to see. But generally speaking, that language just says that we would abide by the federal guideline of 200% instead of the existing state guideline.
Thank you. And we talked about this issue. It was brought to our attention a little late to really fix it on the Senate bill, but I strongly agree with this, and I hope we can incorporate that 200% into this bill if members would be supportive of that. Okay. Representative McNamara has been waiting, then Senator Rummel, then Representative Hilty. Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my for either Mr. Gray or Mr. Anderson, I just have a question about the wage classifications. Because we had some discussion earlier about the canvassers, and in my experience, I'm trying to think, would they be considered laborers? And potentially, they talked about, do you envision those falling under the prevailing wage? If they were to fall under laborers, I mean, it would be more in the neighborhood of $27 an hour than $12. Have you gotten any direction from the feds on where this may be? And then also maybe the other question would be weatherization in general. Will that be in the carpenter trade? Is that what you envision there?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, maybe. As we speak, the Department of Energy, the Federal Department of Energy, and the Department of Labor are in negotiations about how the clause in the stimulus bill is going to apply not only to the weatherization program, but across that wide array of projects, you know, whatever that means, in the stimulus bill. So we're still awaiting official notification of what labor classifications will apply for the weatherization program. You raised the question about canvassers. Very honestly, I'm brand new to the world of Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage. My sense is that it's evolved as a construction institution, and I'm not sure if there is such a thing as ever envisioned as a canvasser. So I don't know how that would apply. But that's a wonderful example of the challenges as we go forward. How are we going to implement this?
And the issue was just brought to my attention that if you include apprentices, that they can be eligible under prevailing wage laws, and they can come in at half the rate. And so you can team an experienced, whatever it is, carpenter, insulator, whoever it is, with an apprentice, save money, and also get those training opportunities at the same time. So that's one thing we should look at. Representative McNamara.
Well, those are all good ideas, Madam Chair, and I just think what's important is, because we don't know exactly how this is going to line up, I think we want to try and structure our bill to be as flexible as possible, realizing, I believe, the prevailing wage has certainly got a lot of good things. We have a lot of those folks that have the experience that aren't working today, but I don't know that they want to do canvassing. They want to put the windows in and do that and the insulation and that kind of work. And so I'm not sure how it all lines up. And we want to get the maximum we can for the money we're spending. So thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you. Who is next? Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gray and Mr. Anderson, you both used the word flexibility, you know, in your testimony. And I'm just wondering if you could give us, if there's anything in the language here, either in the Senate language or the House language, that ties your hands. Can you be more specific?
Madam Chair, Senator, fortunately, we've had some ongoing conversations with both the authors and with other members of the committee. And I think to a large degree, many of the issues that might have existed earlier have been ironed out. The last ones that we're talking about today are probably the only ones that are high, at least on our list. Our bigger concerns are, you know, the Davis-Bacon stuff that needs to be negotiated with the federal government, because there's still a substantial amount that we don't know. We don't know what we can contract people at what wage. There's talk about a separate weatherization rate that might be negotiated. So those are the things that impede our ability to move quickly. And we've gotten assurances from the Department of Commerce and others that these are things that are going to be decided in the very near term. And once they are, I think we'll be able to move very expeditiously to get this done.
Senator Rummel, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just you also referred, I think it was Mr. Anderson, to the training. And, you know, in the Senate language, we're a little bit more specific about addressing underserved or underemployed folks. Do you have any problem with that? You know, one of the things I think about is when we get into a recession thing, the first people that usually get hurt are the folks at the bottom, and then they're the last people that get any help. And so I feel pretty strongly about the Senate language on page 8, well, I guess it would be line 18. I don't know what page that is in here, but 1821 and 1822. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Gray.
We've worked extensively with Representative Champion and others. I know Representative Champion in particular, since he represents my district, has been very much involved in trying to make sure that there's a large outreach component to whatever we do. We've tried to tackle that outside the legislation in many cases by meeting with organizations within the community, by the higher group that has been out in mass in many of the meetings. We've worked with them to try and make sure that there is a seat at the table, that we can utilize members of their organization. But I guess there are two things. First of all, there's a limited number of jobs that are actually available. We're expanding, but we also need to expand in terms of people who have experience at doing this. And that tends to mean that you rely upon existing contractors who've done this for many, many years. We're trying to get them to partner with newer folks who've gone through various training programs so that we can expand and include diversity at the same time. But that's a partnership that we continue to work on. The other piece of it is something that I mentioned the other day, and it's relatively small, but I know in the House language there's talk about the prohibition of folks who've had felony convictions, or folks who've had property violation of some sort, and we understand, and we certainly do background checks on all the people that we utilize, but some flexibility in deciding that someone's offense has been many, many, many years old, maybe when they were much, much younger, and being able to utilize that person and get them back into the economic mainstream is something that we think is valuable. And I know, say, for instance, Lewis King, who's the director of Summit OIC, again, a part of the Higher Coalition, a lot of the folks that come to OIC, to Summit OIC, are folks who've had problems in the past. And they want to clean up their lives, and they want to move on. And for us to put just an arbitrary impediment to them moving forward on these jobs, I think is something that needs to be considered. And again, I know Representative Kalin, I know you have to defend the House position, and I understand that, but I hope that there is some flexibility in looking at that language.
And Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, if I may, we're thrilled by that sentiment and by that question. For those who may not know on the committee or for members in the audience, for more than 30 years, the governing structure of community action agencies is that at least a third of the board members must be low-income Minnesotans themselves. And so we carry that mission and that message not only in our advocacy, but through a wide array of programs that we try to strike that balance, including disadvantaged hiring practices as a way of bringing people into the mainstream economy.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to return for a moment to the question of weatherization of rental units. Try to think how that could possibly work. I think there's only really two situations, one in which the renter pays the utilities and one in which the renter does not pay the utilities. And if the renter does pay the utilities, the landlord would have very little incentive to do anything to lower the renter's utility bills. And if the renter does not pay the utilities, the landlord passes that expense along to the renter anyway, in which case, again, it would have very little incentive to lower those bills. And I'm just wondering how anybody that's thought about this has seen how this could work.
Good question.
Madam Chair and Representative Hilty.
Good answer. I take that
Would you
as
like to phone a friend, Mr. Anderson?
Well, I hope you've had some experience.
I was trying to formulate a concise answer. Within Community Action, we've been having that very discussion within the past few months, and one of the items on our strategic plan is to perhaps in partnership with you form a stakeholders group this summer and fall and try to wrestle once again with that conundrum and see if there is if there are some ways that we can try to improve the incentives or change the incentives for energy conservation across an array of potentials in rental housing. Given the limited number of units that can be weatherized with this stimulus funding, and it really is a finite number of units. We will find some rental units that can be done. We're in communication with Housing Finance and Office of Energy Security on some multifamily units. So they could be more articulate on that particular point. But, yes, we very much share that perspective, and we're cautiously optimistic that perhaps we can take another run at it this year.
Okay. Representative Kalin and Senator Dale.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick follow-up on Representative Hilty's question. I was surprised early on in the bill when we included the rental language, and Jack Horner, lobbies for the Multi-Housing Association, caught me outside of a hearing, and I was prepared for the traditional you want me to vote no or take something out of my bill conversation, and he said, no, we really, really like your bill, and we're especially interested in doing the rental weatherization. So I don't think he needs to show up today to say that again, because he continues to sort of give a thumbs up to it, but I think that we need to include Mr. Horner and his members in that conversation, because clearly there's a reason that they believe that they have overcome what I think Representative Hilty has described as the true conundrum. Separate question or separate issue, former Representative Gray, it is our responsibility to defend the House position, but as you know, I did advocate against the background check amendment and voted against it myself. But I do think that there's a legitimate policy question and a legitimate concern out on this issue, and I know that I think Mr. Anderson and I, we talked about getting a canvas of as many of the caps as we can on what the current practice is. Do we have a sense of how many are conducting background checks before hiring crews, where we're at on this?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, I'm sorry I don't have a precise answer for you. In general, that's already current practice to perform background checks. Not only in the weatherization program, but as you know, community action agencies deliver Head Start and a variety of senior programs, and we're very, very sensitive to protecting people in their homes.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, I, we've had some conversations about finding a way to bring a bill back that is not punitive in the language that that's in the House bill, and can allow entry to those folks who deserve a second chance, who might have committed a very minor offense at 18 and now they're in their 30s or 40s and are on their track, walking the right path for 20 years. Would that be something that you would be comfortable with if we can work out such language?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative Kalin, yes, and we have participated in conversations with Council on Crime and Justice, and I believe they have suggested some language to you that includes background checks, but limits the introduction of that concept until after the interview rather than as a condition of application, which then allows a potential employee the opportunity to discuss their situation rather than just being completely screened out at the outset.
Mr. Gray.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. In Minneapolis, we do background checks. I think certainly in the metro area, that's, the customary practice. I think maybe in some smaller cap agencies where they're far more aware of local vendors, maybe there's a little bit of a more relaxed process. But generally speaking, we're all aware of the fact that in many cases, we're allowing folks entry into the home, sometimes homes of vulnerable adults, and we don't take that lightly. So we understand the sentiment involved in that portion of the bill. We again would ask for some flexibility, and we would love to work with you on that issue. With regard to rental housing getting together, this is a unique opportunity in the sense that it shines a very bright light on what community action has done for a long time. And we've kind of been in the shadows, and we're glad that now this light is being focused because issues like the rental units are coming to the fore, and people who haven't necessarily participated in the conversation are willing to pull up to the table. Because as Mr. Anderson just said earlier, we're hopeful that this isn't a one-time stimulus thing, but something that will be ongoing for many, many years. And so we want to continue this conversation and see how we can make this work even better.
All right. Senator Dale.
Well, Madam Chair, members, on R5, we've got this language that deals with background checks, employment prohibited. It's a part of the bill we've been talking about the last few minutes, and as far as I'm concerned, this makes this a pro-crime bill. And I think we should not accept federal stimulus money to stimulate crime. And that's what this does. And we've been doing it over and over and over and over again for decades. And it's time for it to stop. We've got people that make mistakes in our society. They go to jail. They go to prison. They pay fines. They get older. Their brain finally matures at age 25. And to put an albatross around their neck for the rest of their life is absolutely outrageous. And these people are getting back out into society, and they can't find a place to live. They can't find a job. And what can they do? They've got to eat. But they can steal to get money to eat. And before long, they're back in prison. And we think the recidivism rate is so terrible. And it's because we pass laws like this. And I think this section of the law should not go forward from this conference committee. It should be removed entirely. And I think we should actually put something in there that says you've got to hire some crooks. Because they need a job.
I think
this idea that we're the home of the free, the home of the free and the land of the brave, the land of the free and the home of the brave, we're a bunch of cowards. Because we don't dare give people a job that made a mistake in their life. And as I think about my own family and the jobs that we've given people that have been crooks, it's almost always worked out. And I remember the first person my dad gave a job to that was a crook was a guy that had been in the Montana State Penitentiary for stealing saddles. And we hired him to work on the farm, a Montana cowboy. And we gave him a house to live in with his wife and kid. No indoor plumbing, had to use wood to heat the water in the house and cook food and all that. but he was the kind of guy that felt like a Rockefeller because he had a $20 bill in his pocket. And he was satisfied with that kind of accommodations, and he worked out just fine for a year. And then he moved on. And I remember I hired a guy who had been fishing with his friend, and then they cleaned the fish with, they each had a knife, and they got into some disagreement over this fish cleaning operation, and this guy wound up in the McLeod County Jail. And when he finally got out, he didn't have a place to live, he didn't have a job, he did have his pickup truck, and when I found him, he was a homeless man living in the back of his pickup truck, but I gave him a job and a house to live in, and he worked for me for several years, and it worked out just fine. Then I hired a drunk who couldn't have a driver's license, but he could drive my tractor. And when I was gone one day, he drove the tractor down to Kingston and got drunk and got into a fight. And when he was driving my tractor home, he was the only guy that year in Meeker County that got arrested for drunken tractor driving. And I would say he's the only crook that didn't work out. But at any rate, we have to take some risks here and help these people because they people make mistakes. We had a dog and cat bill this year, a regulated dog and cat. You know what was in there? If you were ever in your life convicted of cruelty to animals, you could never, ever again, ever work on a dog farm. That's outrageous. Some 16-year-old makes a mistake. His dad's got a dog farm, he pays his dues to society, and he can't even get a job on his dad's dog farm because he made a mistake. And we're just making it impossible for these people, and provisions like this is pro-crime. It makes people become criminals, and it makes them stay criminals. And I want this section out of the law.
Well, Senator Dill, thank you for your passion and your eloquence on that. I appreciate that. And I guess it does kind of make me wonder why this is here, given that in all the years that these programs have existed, I don't recall ever hearing of any, axe murderers going and weatherizing someone's home. I think we would know about it if that had happened. And so I don't think this is one of those, solutions in search of a problems in search of whichever way that goes. It doesn't. I don't think there's a problem here that you're trying to solve with this language, so appreciate your comments. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dill, you make a number of good points. I think just to try and mention some of where the House was coming from, the concern that we are going to be in a lot of people's homes working on their windows and such like that, the insulation. The concern that there is the ability for someone to set up a situation where they potentially would come back into the home later on. And I, Senator Dill, understand a lot of what you're talking about. Some of the best kids I liked hiring the kids that were the juvenile delinquents and in trouble because when you got them out in the nursery on the farm, they wanted to prove to everybody how hard they could work, and there was a lot of value in that. I'm just wondering, Madam Chair, and we don't have to do it now, but at some point, maybe there's somewhere where we can address most of Senator Dill's concerns, but maybe there's some limited individuals that we would want to not necessarily be leaving in these single-family homes. I got to be honest. I don't think we have a problem with them being on commercial sites and public buildings, things like that. I just think in the limited instance where maybe they're getting in some of the small neighborhood communities, any neighborhood communities where they're in the individual homes, potentially just some of the most serious criminals, I think, and only in those instances. And I guess I would just offer that possibility up for thought.
Well, my comeback on that is how many people get out of prison or jail, they can't get a job, and then they enter somebody's house because they need to steal something to live? I mean, you got far more people doing that than you have people that, if they got a job and they got a paycheck coming, they don't have to break into somebody's house. And the lingo here says crime against property. How many kids have been stupid enough to damage property when they were young? This is a lifetime sentence, the way this thing reads. You can never get a job nailing on weather stripping if you have a crime against property. That's outrageous.
Well, Representative Kaelin.
Chair, Senator Dill, when we chatted this morning, the first thing the first exchange we said was, in essence, glad to meet you. I know we've met before, but we've never had a chance to work together. And some of the senators I have always spoken quite well of you, and I can see why. I think you have a very reasonable and passionate position, both, and that's rare around here. I would like to find a way. I mean, I know that if it's existing practice to do some sort of background check for the true threats, I really believe in the weatherization program. I really believe in the work that we're going to do in this bill, and I do not like legislating from fear because I think we do that way too often. But I would hate to see a terrible incident become the story of the week or the month. And so I hope that we can find a way to do a reasonable effort here to comply, to ensure that all the caps are doing what most of the caps are doing. I think Representative McNamara probably articulates a position we're going to hear that I would hear if I came back from the conference committee without any background check. And I would like to find a way to do that.
So, Senator Dillon. Just one more point, members. And I was kind of stunned when Senator Higgins gave me this several-page document listing all the occupations that people can't do if they've made a mistake. And most of them are for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, or maybe forever. They can never do many, 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 many jobs because they made a mistake. And even to wait 5 years before you can do a job, how do you survive for 5 years? Our laws are riddled with this kind of stuff, and it's pro crime. We are doing that. We think we're protecting the public, but we're making the public more at risk because people that get out of jail, prison, they have to return to a life of crime because that's the only option they've got.
Representative Kalin, I hear what you're saying, but I would ask the question, and Representative McNamara, why weatherization providers? Why not every plumber and electrician and utility meter reader and anyone else who's ever set foot in your house and the mailman who comes in my front porch every day to drop the mail off? Why are we going to – is that the road we're going down, or is it just – something special about weatherization that makes this necessary?
Well, Madam Chair, I'll just point out that you could have actually just read my comments on this amendment from the House floor verbatim.
Okay.
Because that was my concern, is that I think that there was a sort of selection for some reason, and I'm not sure what, for these specific folks, whereas the MHFA loan program, for instance, is not covered. Mm-hmm. So I think you raise a good concern. But I do hope, I do think that there's a legitimate issue here that we do need to resolve, and perhaps if we treat Minnesotans fairly by making sure all Minnesotans are covered, I don't know. I know Representative McNamara.
Well, Madam Chair, if between today and tomorrow, if I could have a chance, I'll talk with Representative Seifert, I believe it was his amendment, and see what his thoughts are. Representative Dill very eloquently makes a number of great points that I'd like to bring back to Representative Seifert, and if I could come back tomorrow, that would be good.
That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you for a great discussion on that, members. All right. Any other questions for the CAP agencies? If not,
closing
yes,
comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Kalin.
I know we have to move along, but I just want to say thank you. Personally, I don't know if we'll have more chance to have you at the table tomorrow. Obviously, we won't pass any language without getting a chance to make sure it works in terms of flexibility offline. But to Mr. Anderson specifically, it's been a pleasure working with you from the very beginning when we saw this on the table, from the sort of massive gulp of, oh, my gosh, what will this mean? To then discovering the prevailing wage provision and all the little pieces here and out. And so as you've been doing all the other things that have been needed by our most needy Minnesotans in a time of great economic crisis, in addition to having this opportunity heaped on you, which is maybe as much of a curse as a blessing, I want to thank you, Mr. Gray, and all the folks who are out there doing the very, very difficult work of implementing this procedure, including the fact, including dealing with Senator Anderson and myself, potentially holding up some the first pass of funding, which we resolved, thank God, and can make sure you guys can ramp up, and let's put Minnesotans to work and help them meet their energy bills without having to take away from their food budgets. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Committee members.
Appreciate it. And members, you know, I just have to point out, I just came off my budget conference committee, which was, you know, 150-page budget, over $1 billion, and that took us 3 days. We took hardly any testimony on that whole entire budget. And this is a little unusual to take this level of input, but I just think on this bill, if we've got a little bit of time to spend today, it's really important. And I don't know, this is just a matter, it's new. This is something new that we're doing, we haven't done before,
and a larger budget.
So I appreciate members' indulgence in taking some time for public testimony on this. I think it's been really a good use of our time. And I'd like to ask now if there's anyone else besides the Commerce Department that would like to say anything. Ms. Lauder, come on up.
I believe Senator Dill has the camera.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Could you identify yourself and make your statement?
Mr. Chair, Lori Lauder of the St. Paul Port Authority, and Peter Klein here with me. I hope we're here at the appropriate time. I didn't want to jump the gun, so Mr. Jarofsky, maybe you can help out here. We're here to just say a couple of quick words on the language for commercial industrial. Would that be appropriate, Mr. Chair?
Well, that would be appropriate. What page are you on?
We are on page R11.
And do you
R11 is the start of it. It goes on to page R12.
And do you have language that is prepared in written form to pass out, or
Mr. Chairman and committee members, we do not. One of the comments we have is very simple, however. We would like to suggest that the Senate language is the language that should be used for this program, and specifically on page R12, line 8.15, this would help the Excel utility, the energy utility, to see that language there, that one line in 8.15, is deleted. We had some discussion in the informal meeting yesterday. I think in general, and Representative Kalin, please correct me if you think otherwise, but I think that was acceptable to everyone. It's just a technical change that then allows the utility to obtain all of the green credits that it would have due to it as being part of this program. So, Mr. Chair, we would recommend that one change.
Well, okay, so just so I understand it completely, you want to delete the five words on line 8.15. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir, in the Senate bill, yes.
Right, and what else do you have?
And, Mr. Chairman, just wanted to say a couple of other quick things here. In terms of the Senate language, with all due respect to all of the hard work that's been done in the House language, particularly by Representative Kalin, we find that the technical language involved in the Senate version, as we have discussed with everyone yesterday and some other discussions over the past few weeks, is the one that allows any local government unit or any port authority to proceed with this program for a couple of reasons. Number one, on the revolving loan fund element, it provides the grant to the local government or port authority, which then allows the local government or port authority to turn around and provide loans to commercial industrial businesses. That's very clear in the Senate version.
Okay, could I excuse me for just a minute? Tell me what line you're on and what page.
Yes, on page R11, Mr. Chair, Senate version. It starts on line 7.30, the utility service area, and then goes into really 7.31 starts to get to the revolving loan component, 7.31 and 3.2. And that's just fine. It provides a specificity of language compared to the House bill that makes a lot of sense programmatically. As I mentioned, it's just a technical item. The other thing, Mr. Chair, since we're on that portion, if you would look at, line items 7.29 and 7.30 discusses the utilities service area. And as Senator Anderson has indicated throughout this afternoon from time to time, on this component of your bill, the utility, in this case Xcel, its service area is approximately one-half of the state. And so any local unit of government or any port authority working with Xcel in this way would be able to undertake its activity within the service area. So that's also there. And, Mr. Chairman, we have mentioned just now the conservation improvement and savings credit towards the goal of the utility, so that I have no other language changes. Pete Klein is here. Pete is our Vice President of Finance. If you have any questions in terms of where we are conceptually with this, we'd be happy to answer any questions. But again, we appreciate your consideration of deleting that one line we just spoke about and providing approval of the Senate version, which then provides all the technical abilities for a local government or a port authority to move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lauder, how many port authorities exist in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to look at that to be sure. My understanding is something like 64 port authorities. However, there are four fully operational port authorities along waterways. But I believe as far as port authorities that have certain economic development powers, that's somewhere in the 60s. I could stand to be corrected, certainly by House or Senate counsel.
And, Madam Chair.
Representative Hilty.
Ms. Lauder, is it the case that this language as it's drafted refers to only one of them?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair and Representative Hilty, as I read the language in the Senate on line 7.19, mentions a port authority created under Chapter 469. And again, I'm not counsel, so I could stand to be corrected here, but my understanding is that's a generic version of a port authority as opposed to, for example, the St. Paul Port Authority, which Madam Chair has mentioned earlier. We were the entity that conceptualized this program. That is my understanding.
Madam Chair, perhaps counsel could enlighten us as to what port authority is created by Section 469.084.
Yeah, Representative Hilty, I think it may apply. It may refer to the St. Paul Port Authority. I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Pete just reminded me. Yes, as we looked at that, that does refer. I'm very sorry. That does refer specifically to the St. Paul Port Authority.
And then to say local governments, I think that would local government units would encompass. That would include other port authorities as well as cities, counties, et cetera. Is that true, Ms. Doyle, or Mr. Eloff? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say that yes, the citation in there is specific to the Port Authority of St. Paul and the local government units. I'm not 100% sure if that does include port authorities, but we could provide a definition of local government units. What, Mr. Eloff?
Well, as I read 469.084, it was only there were no local governments under there, so I'm reading this to it seems to me to apply to any local government units.
Right.
And the St. Paul Port
right.
Authority.
That's our intention.
That's your intention.
Yeah.
Madam Chair,
Representative Hilty.
So then am I to interpret that although there exists some 60-odd port authorities in the state, The only one that would be eligible under this language would be the St. Paul Port Authority?
Representative Hilty, that's not my intention, but I just assumed that they were subsumed under local units of government, so that any other city, whatever government entity they want to use, could apply for this as well.
Well, Madam Chair, in that case, there wouldn't be any need to reference Port Authority at all.
Except for this one.
Which is not, which would not fall under the local unit of government?
It would. But this was originally drafted as a Port Authority bill, and the intention was that the St. Paul Port Authority would run this program for the XL service territory. And so, which as we've mentioned is about half the state, but we didn't want to have it be exclusively the XL service territory or a program run exclusively by the St. Paul Port Authority, but we wanted to make sure that this program was part of the mix. And so that's the intention of the language, and if it needs to be clarified, we can certainly do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kalin.
Madam Chair, I'm disappointed to hear that 469.084 is the St. Paul Port Authority, because I thought it was the Franconia Port Authority, which is a tiny little hamlet on St. Croix in my district. And so I was really hoping that's what it was, but I hear council tells us otherwise. We've on the Green Jobs Task Force, I think that Ms. Lauder really helped bring together a few concepts that were really key in terms of finding a way to do loan guarantees that we heard from our market analysis team that's worked in D.C. and Pennsylvania and many other states. And I think, again, like the Duluth project, that this is an opportunity to showcase a new financing structure, a new partnership. Excel has been at the table. I think that it's a ripe project, but I think that my understanding is it has moved from just a St. Paul focus to the entire service territory of XL Energy. So it really does cover, as I think you've said, half the state.
Well, Representative Kalin, as introduced, the bill intended was written to cover all of XL service
yes.
territory, but so it would be administered by the St. Paul Port Authority. So I think that's where people maybe got the impression it's just for St. Paul, but it was from the very beginning intended to be covering half the state and businesses across that half of the state. But I think we got a lot of interest from other parts of the state as well, and so we wanted to make sure that everyone in Minnesota, other communities, would have a chance to participate. And it could certainly be other local governments within XL service territory might want to work on this as well.
Well, Madam Chair,
as out of XL area.
I think the idea is ripe. I think the structure of the bill and the language might need just a little bit of tweaking and maybe even some articulation. Obviously, we have to decide whether we're going to go with a framework bill or a line item bill, but this is one of the earlier questions we did the side-by-side about. I think the project is worthy, and I think we should figure out whether or how much to allocate specifically to it, and then also how we should articulate it so that it really does do what we want it to do and that we can engage the partners in the way that the project is intended to engage them. And so I don't think we're crafting specific language right now, but I think we'll have to have a discussion tomorrow about the language on 732 to 7 or to 84 that seem to be about other options. I don't know if they're within the service area, if there are other parts of the $7 million general allocation for CNI.
The part about the biofuel facilities?
Yeah,
it's just not designated. That's just for the whole project across the state, and it would be up to Commerce to decide where in Minnesota a good use of those grants would be. Could be anywhere.
I think that's to my point.
Could I ask Ms. Lauder or Mr. Klein, just really briefly, just give us sort of the two sentences about how much energy? I mean, you called this the Trillion BTU project, and that's what really got me excited at the very beginning. Just say, you know, without going into all the whole story, but just quickly, how much we can expect, you know, what the results could be from this.
We came up with the Trillion BTU and determined that with approximately $24 million investment in, combined with SIP funds, that we could save approximately 1 trillion BTU every year. And that's the equivalent of one half of downtown St. Paul's energy use every year. And depending on the funding that is available, we still think that we can hit that 1 trillion BTU savings. It may take a little bit longer, but we do intend to leverage the funds that are granted to this program, leverage them as significantly as possible. And we do feel that the 1 trillion BTU savings will be obtained in a relatively short period of time.
Thank you. Any other questions about this? All right. Oh, Ms. Lauder.
Madam Chair, just another quick comment in terms of market interest. And Pete has been doing some incredible work as far as already talking to some businesses, and we have a lot of business interest. And as you mentioned, this would be for fully half the state, and we fully expect a lot more interest as well. So thank you very much.
Great, thank you. All right. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify? Come on up, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kit Richardson with Schaefer Richardson Real Estate Company. I just want to very quickly piggyback on the previous testimony. And I'm on, wanted to refer to our language on R12 and just talk very briefly about the difference between the Senate and House language as it pertains to the definition of renewable resources, and point out that in the Senate language, starting 8.2, and actually this occurs elsewhere in the Senate language, hydrothermal and geothermal are included in the Senate language. And if you look on the House side, starting also R12 line 923, the definition of renewable energy source does not include hydrothermal or geothermal. And I would ask that if there is discussion and negotiation back and forth between the House and the Senate language, that geothermal and hydrothermal be included. Again, looking at it from a broader perspective and looking at it from making this bill more flexible to deal with as broad a range of renewable resources as possible. And also, as I think most of you know, most of the people in the room know, geothermal is probably the oldest proven technology, subject only to hydroelectric. It's been used in Europe over 50 years, and so it's something that is available. And just as a footnote to that last question about 1 trillion BTUs, we're looking at a project using hydrothermal that on an annual basis would save 1,750,000 tons of cooling annually. A BTU is about 12,000, or one ton is about 12,000 BTUs. My calculator didn't have enough zeros, but when I did it by hand, that comes over to that comes to more than 1 trillion BTUs just in one project alone, just using water, river water, and geothermal. So I just encourage the House and the Senate to include geothermal and hydrothermal. And very quickly, hydrothermal is when we're using water. Great River Energy has what I would call a pond loop. The slinky device is actually sitting in the pond, the lake. Geothermal is typically when you go into the ground. Hydrothermal, when you're using river water or pond or lake water. So it's a broader definition, if you will. So I'd be happy to answer questions, but thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hilty.
Thank you. Mr. Richardson?
Richardson, yes.
you've referred a number of times to hydrothermal, which language I do not actually find in the bill. Are we taking that to be synonymous with using river water?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm using hydrothermal here as our engineers have been using it, and it is a broader definition, if you will. Hydrothermal would include a device which is placed in river water, pond, lake water, directly in a body of water, whether or not it's still water, pond or lake, or moving water, a river. Geothermal would refer to a system that is in the earth. Obviously, wet earth is more conductive and therefore it's more efficient, but it's a distinction that we're making because we're using bodies of water as opposed to the earth.
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Richardson, what I'm saying is I don't find any language in the bill that where the I don't find the term hydrothermal appearing anywhere in the bill.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think you are right. It is referred to, but it does not use the word. You are correct. It does not use the word hydrothermal on line 8.2.
And Madam Chair, that was my original question. Should we take hydrothermal to be synonymous with using river water? But Mr. Richardson, according to what you just told us, I think what you would be proposing to do in the project you mentioned is to essentially warm the river by a trillion BTUs. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, actually, it's interesting. Our engineering studies have shown, and we would be heating and cooling. So the system works both ways. The studies have shown that the capacity of the volume of water that is flowing through the tunnel, or could flow through the tunnel today, there is water flowing through the tunnel today, the capacity of that volume and the speed suggests that at that cooling and heating level, the temperature of the water would rise less than 1 degree Fahrenheit. There is so much volume of water moving through that resource, and that is a tunnel that exists today. So the preliminary studies have shown that the temperature of the river water would go up less than 1 degree at that level of heating and cooling.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Richardson, do you know what the ecological effects of that temperature rise would be then?
Madam Chair, Representative, in my discussions with people at DNR and at the EPA, I was told that the threshold is of temperature rise is around 5 degrees. We are under that according to the engineering studies. But we have not looked at the effect of the less than 1 degree rise in temperature yet. As it turns out, after the water flows through the tunnel, it also then drops through two 48-foot drop shafts. Interestingly, also from an engineering point of view, Representative, those drop shafts serve as cooling towers. So when the water is heated, it also will be then cooled as it falls 48 feet to the bottom of the drop shaft. And then there is about an eighth of a mile flow from the bottom of the drop shaft into the main channel of the river. So it appears as though we're clearly under the 5 degree threshold. We appear to be under the 1 degree rise.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony, Mr. Pfeiffer. And let me just ask, because besides the Commerce Department, is there anyone else who'd like to testify this evening? Okay, maybe one more. All right, great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dan
Welcome
Pfeiffer with Xcel Energy, and I just wanted to thank the Port Authority for the attempt to take that one provision out of the bill at line 8.15, I think it is. That's important to us, and I just wanted to speak to its importance. With that provision in there, We would probably be inclined to participate in other energy conservation projects brought to us that would allow us to count all of the energy savings. And I don't think that's the intent of anyone trying to change that. So we appreciate their effort to fix that. And then I just wanted to generally speak in favor of the project. We think that as we look at commercial and industrial energy conservation, someone that can help us hit the ground and deliver some projects quickly so that we fit into the time frame of the stimulus funding is important. We know they've got the ability to help with that. We know other local units of government do as well. So the fact that we can leverage some energy savings and take advantage of providing at least our contribution towards the state's energy savings goal is something I just wanted to speak in favor of.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pfeiffer, while you're there, I guess I'd like to follow up. Aren't you in a position to know as a utility some folks, maybe some zip codes, some specific area, or my guess is you may even know individual houses, and I'm trying to envision how we can utilize that information at the same point. I don't imagine you're free to just go to some public agency and say, hey, the McNamara house on 6th and Pine is using twice as much electricity or gas as they should be for the size of the house. They probably need new windows. Maybe the McNamaras don't want you telling somebody that for whatever reason. Is there something, is there a way that we can click together? Do you envision this?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. There is a PUC restriction that we're not allowed to disclose customer-specific energy use to a third party. So that prohibits us from being able to send a list out to an agency that would let them know who the high energy users were, per se, in a neighborhood. We would be interested in working to see if there's a way we could provide some aggregated information so that maybe there's a way that average energy use could be discerned for a community without knowing, without people being able to figure out that your particular home is one that's using more energy than your neighbor.
Representative McNamara.
But Mr. Pfeiffer, I guess I appreciate that part. But how about if we go back again to our house specifically, where if I remember right, before we remodeled, it was an older home built in 1910, had no insulation, windows needed replacing, we replaced the siding. And if I remember right, our gas bill went from $180 on the budget to $100, almost cut in half. Is there a way that you can identify or just know folks that have high amounts of energy bill, and couldn't we work with you to tailor to say, go to this household and say, you know, there's programs out there now. You can get a cost share for windows if you meet an economic threshold, or there is the $1,500 available under the stimulus. I mean, it just seems you've got this good information. I'm wondering, why would we have somebody going door to door to door, having the door slammed in their face so many times? Granted, they're going to hit a home run once in a while, when you might be able to get some good information. And then maybe these folks can come out and visit our home and say, yeah, here's what we could do there. I mean, are you willing to work with this, and is there a way that this could potentially work?
Mr. Pfeiffer.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I think this gets back to the earlier part of my point, which is we've got this restriction that would prohibit us from letting a third party know particular customer's energy. We do have programs that involve getting information out to our customers, direct mailing programs, bill inserts that was discussed, information on our website that lets folks know what's available. Hopefully they come to us with questions, and then we can engage in how we can help them with their energy use.
Representative McNamara.
Well, and I think you just hit on it, the key there. So I send a card back to you and says, yeah, I'd like new windows, maybe I'd like new insulation. Would it then be okay? And maybe on the card it says, yeah, I'd like to have the XYZ group stop by and talk to me. You wouldn't have a problem with letting the XYZ group know that the McNamaras have asked for you to come out to their house? Is that begin to work with what you can do?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, and I think I was remiss in stating earlier that we do provide information on customers' energy use, provided that customer has signed a consent, allowing us to share that information with someone else. So to the extent that they were solicited, gave information back to us that also included the consent for us to provide energy information or some other energy information to a third party, is something we would be able to work with.
Madam Chair, if I can, Mr. Pfeiffer, I don't think you need to give them the energy information. I think it's more if you could break the cold call ability to where this the McNamara's, again, now are willing to have somebody come out to their house and they let you know, do you have a problem it being not XL coming out to our house, but maybe the agency that was here earlier, one of their groups come out and visit with the different options that are available to us. I'm assuming you don't want to do that, I wouldn't think.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I don't think we would have a problem with that. I don't want to overstep my okay. bounds since I don't work directly with all of our energy conservation programs and all the requirements that it has. I don't think that would be a problem, and I know we're looking forward to working with the folks that are going to be on the ground doing this so that we can help them be as effective as they can be.
Representative McNamara.
The very last time. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, maybe, Mr. Pfeiffer, if it's possible, if you could find any more information out by tomorrow, if you would have the ability to work with other, I would, if we would possibly be able to know that, I think that would be beneficial. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom wanted to help answer this question. While he comes up, Senator Dill and then Representative Hilty had their hands up.
Very quickly, I'm Sheldon Strom with the Center for Energy and Environment. And as Mr. Pfeiffer might remember, we are working jointly with Xcel on a community-based program. We're going to actually be working in 8 cities with some LCMR funding that we're getting. But what that allows us to do is after the customer gives a release, we're able to analyze the customer's energy use and also compare it with assessor's data and other information and basically get a pretty good indication of how well that house is doing. We create what we call a flame index, which is like miles per gallon for a car. It's the gas use per square foot per degree day for the house. And we do the same thing for electricity. And we're working with Xcel and CenterPoint and others to deliver a program like this using community-based contacts, including some of the search teams, where we will go out there and give the customer a wide range of services. So I think there is a very proactive effort now to start going after the residential market. I think, as Senator Anderson had mentioned, I think for more than a decade, utilities didn't really focus on the residential market. But now, starting in the next 6 months, I think most utilities are going to have aggressive programs to serve the residential market, and a lot of those will involve using the community to do that outreach.
Great, thank you. All right, Senator Dill, did you talk yet? Sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to let Representative McNamara know that I think he's got a good idea. I think that line of questioning sounded very promising. The only thought that occurred to me as it was unfolding is whether there's some adjustment in state law that might be appropriate or if there's some way to make it more easy for Xcel to provide information. Mr. Pfeiffer talked about the PUC prohibiting him from releasing certain information. That's probably appropriate. And Mr. Fuller down here, who's the big expert, maybe there's some thought that we could make some adjustment there to make it easier to do what you're talking about, because I think you've got a good idea.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my question was for Mr. Pfeiffer, who tried to escape, but.
Do you have any really wise thoughts?
Mr. Pfeiffer, could you help me understand in less abstract terms the implications of the presence or absence of the language on line 8.15 that both you and Ms. Lauder referred to?
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, yes, my understanding is that if we had an opportunity to participate with, let's say, another lending institution that brought us was able to partner with one of our customers to do an energy conservation project, And on par, it was the same project that we could partner with a unit of government or a port authority under this provision. We would tend to choose the one that allowed us to count all of the energy savings, which is currently how we do all of the projects we work with now, whether that money comes to the customer from capital inside their company, whether it comes from financing that they arrange. We count the energy savings regardless of the percentage of the rebate that we provide. So this is a dramatic shift in how we would be doing this moving forward if we were only going to be counting percent of savings that's equal to the percent of our involvement in terms of a rebate, if I'm answering your question.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Pfeiffer, you're telling me that normally you're allowed to count more energy savings towards your conservation goal than you actually have any involvement in generating?
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, let me give you an example. If a customer came to us and said they plan to put a new chiller in their commercial building, and we were going to be providing them a $2,500 rebate, let's say it was a $10,000 chiller for just example purposes, the energy savings that's delivered by that project, we would count all of the energy savings, not just 25% of it. Under this provision, if it stays in the bill the way it is, we would only be counting 25% of the energy savings.
Thank you.
Can I ask Mr. Fuller just to comment on Senator Dill's comment? It's about how to make that sort of adjustment.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not all that wise, but he's right. If, in fact, there's a state PUC rule that limits the disclosure of information by a regulated utility, and there's not a federal basis for it or constitutional basis for it, which I doubt, then we would have the authority to change those rules. We would probably be well advised to get a firm understanding of why the rule's in place and before we because there may be a reason that we're not aware of. I can't think of one now, but they must have some solid reason for doing that.
And it would, it's a really interesting discussion. I'm not sure that's kind of a big policy shift that we couldn't really just add into a conference committee without having discussed it, I think, in policy committees. But I think it's an important idea that we should keep talking about.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Kalin.
Representative Bly had a bill this year, and I can't remember exactly what the whether it's Representative Welty's or I think it was Representative Bly's bill, where we had a significant discussion in the House on this question, a sort of on-bill payment versus on how much information can be shared on the bill that can be a catalyst to I think where Representative McNamara's question went to, kind of and initially during the CERT's Altoids conversation. And so I think, Senator Dill, I think you're right on that it's a good idea. And there are Sacramento Municipal Utility and PG&E, I think, Pacific Gas and Electric. I think those are the two that are piloting. I'm looking at OES staff for confirmation that those are the two that are piloting some on-bill information that can become the motivator to take action and it's been a partnership with the utility. I think that we should see that bill gets an adequate discussion next year in both the House and Senate and that we move on it. The civil libertarian in me is always a little bit worried about the relationship with Chapter 13 and the data practices, privacy information for consumers, and so I think to find a way to tie those threads together, ultimately, I would love to see us not adjourn sine die next year without making progress on this specific issue, because it's really utilities have the information for us and they can compare us to our neighbors, which is really the most motivating thing. I want to be better than my neighbor. As turns out, that all the research has shown that it has little to do with carbon footprint or cost. It's really keeping up with the McNamara's and the Nelsons, and so we should look at that and move on it. But I think there's some significant policy hurdles that we should overcome. thoughtfully rather than trying to do it in 24 hours. But I'd love to talk to you more about it, Senator, to make it work.
Well, and I just want to point out on R14, the Senate does have some language under the CERT's proposal that would – this is a senator from a Senator Limmer's Senate floor amendment that we refined through some discussion on the Senate floor to make sure that the data collected by any kind of a door-to-door canvas would be private data on individuals as well. So there are significant policy issues involved in this. Representative McNamara.
Mr. Pfeiffer, if I may, I thought of this and I wanted to ask you earlier. Almost all our discussion today is, Senator, I shouldn't say almost all, but a lot of it has been around resident, single family, residential, energy savings and thing we can do. My experience is in business there was substantial energy savings when we changed some practices. Are we missing anything in your thoughts? Maybe I shouldn't be asking your opinion, but I just wanted to confirm.
It's only in the Senate.
Isn't the reality that there's a lot of opportunities in industry, commercial, public buildings, schools, and such for substantial energy savings? And a lot of that's addressed in the bill. But is there an industry percentage? Does Xcel know something like how much energy can be saved, or is there a dollar return historically where it's been better or worse?
Mr. Pfeiffer.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, if I remember the number correctly, we as a company get about 95% of our energy savings from the commercial and industrial market currently, which is why we're very pleased with the provision in the bill that allows us to participate with the commercial and industrial program. As we have this pretty aggressive energy conservation goal of 1.5%, we're, of course, interested in making sure we go after the market that has the biggest bang for the buck. We like the commercial industrial market as well because it's about sustaining jobs and growing jobs and doing the things I think we're trying to accomplish here. So that's why I rose to speak in favor of that provision in the bill. I think there are some other things in the bill as we look at the school opportunities, the local government opportunities that we can definitely participate in. I know our marketing folks are getting ready to figure out how they're going to partner with school districts and others to make sure that we're there leveraging the energy conservation programs we have with the stimulus money that they're going to receive.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your patience. And Mr. Pfeiffer, wouldn't there be opportunities in those markets quicker and easier for us to jump on and get those projects up and running and get people to working probably quicker and easier? Don't we have to realize that? I mean, one big building that we can move forward on with window replacement or light fixture changes or whatever, I see as potentially a great opportunity to be working on this summer, where some of the residential in that might take till the fall or something to really get the program clicking.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I do know from talking to our folks in the marketing and sales area of the company that there are commercial and industrial customers that have the ability to jump onto some plans that they've had put in place. I don't want to minimize, though, and I want to support what Mr. Strom said a few minutes ago. The residential market is a tough one for us to crack, and it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of effort. So we understand that's an area we need to move into. We've written the playbook for the commercial industrial market. We do it very well, and it's where we get the majority of our results. But we do recognize that moving into the residential market is something that needs to be done, and so I don't want to minimize the potential that's out there. We just haven't figured out probably a cost-effective way to do it at this point.
Well, Mr. Pfeiffer, I guess the question's been raised. Is it better for Xcel to go door-to-door and knock on doors to see if there's residences that want energy efficiency improvements, or better to partner with some other community groups or nonprofits to do that sort of thing?
Madam Chair, I think it's fair to say if we thought it was in our cost-effective interest to do so, we'd probably be doing it already.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. All right, we have from the Higher Coalition, is it Mr. Ness or coming forward? Okay. Welcome to the conference committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'd like to start by thanking you for all of your work that you've done, especially Senator Anderson and Representative Kalin, and all the staff that have worked on this bill. It is appreciated. My name is Patrick Ness. I'm the Public Policy Manager with Catholic Charities Office for Social Justice and a member of the Higher Minnesota Coalition. We're a coalition of 65 organizations represented by workforce development, religious entities, environmental groups, anti-poverty, and community nonprofits. Our mission is to ensure equity in the hiring that will come with the federal recovery dollars, as well as this emerging green economy. We've engaged over 1,500 community members over the last 4 to 5 months in town hall forums, small group conversations. We've been up to Duluth. We've been in Lindstrom. We've been all over having conversations about this project. Our asks are simple, and they haven't changed. We're focusing on outreach, making sure that low-income communities know about the opportunities available to them in these recovery dollars. We are asking for training dollars for low-income folks who otherwise would not be able to afford them. We are asking for reporting and accountability measures to ensure that these dollars are, in fact, benefiting all Minnesotans across the state. This is a stimulus bill, and there's no better way to stimulate the economy than putting paychecks in the hands of low-income workers and families. They will spend all of those dollars immediately. You saw a handful of the workers today that we are partnering with. They are currently in a 5-month carpentry training, which now includes a weatherization component. They are skilled, they are trained, and they're ready to go. I know my brother, who lives in Duluth, earned about $8,000 last year as a maintenance man working on homes where he could. He's married, he has a child, he's uninsured, and he made $8,000. He signed up for the Energy Auditor class through Dunwoody. It's going to be up in Cloquet in July, and it costs about $750. And so that's about 10% of his annual income, which is not going to work out. And so he's counting on this. And all the workers that we saw in this program are counting on access to the training dollars. We are thrilled that Community Action Partnerships are administering this program. They share our mission, and we're looking forward to partnering with them along the way as we try to put some workers on the job. We look forward to working with this committee, with the departments, with the community actions to ensure that this happens. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ness. Are there questions? All right. Thanks so much for being here. We appreciate it. And thanks for bringing lots of people to participate in this process. It's really been great. All right. Anybody else? All right. Let's bring up the Commerce Department once again. Members, I think we have a plan here. I think we'll go through Commerce's testimony, and that's going to take a little time to go through it in detail. And then I think we're going to adjourn for the evening, and Representative Kalin and I need to talk a little, and we'll try to, if members want to talk to each other or to other interested parties about trying to come up with any resolution to any of the issues that have been raised, that would be really, really helpful. And then hopefully we can come back first thing in the morning ready to start adopting language and putting the bill together. So that's the plan. So... if there's questions, Representative Kalin.
I'll just point out, as I'm talking with a carrot in my mouth, that our agreement has been that the chair who doesn't have the gavel brings snacks when needed. And so if conferees need a little blood sugar boost, we have carrots going around. And please come and grab something that you need to keep your attention on our three experts.
Thank you. All right, who would like to, Mr. Glahn, are you ready to turn it over to your partners here?
Madam Chair, yes, I am. I would.
Hang on, pardon me, I'm really sorry, but we need to change our tape. So if we could just Take out.